Stay tuned, Richard. We'll be right back. All right, Rachel, let's go. Go!
Hey everybody, we're live. Hi everyone. That's what I said. Hi. I forgot how to say hi to the live stream. It's been a busy few weeks.
Yeah. Well, you've got the restaurant reopening imminently, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's St. Patrick's Day celebration this Saturday, and then we reclose, and then the whole kitchen crew and everybody comes back for full opening in mid to late April. So we're getting ready for that.
That's exciting. Did you ever finish your Dante not rollout? What's the opposite of a rollout? Like retirement?
Roll up? Roll in?
Roll up, yeah. Roll in?
When you push the button on a tape measure
and it
comes back in, what do you... Yeah. Anyway, the bay was frozen for like 6 weeks this winter, and there was no ferry service that entire time, which I was able to like bum a ride from people who have driving permits a couple of times in the middle there just to kind of like, water our plants and check on things. But like I couldn't spend large spans of time there for a month and a half. So all of the time that I would have taken to do all that wiring and stuff, I just didn't have that time this winter. Thank God we did all this stuff last winter for most things. And so we are about to we're about to open for the St. Patrick's Day thing. And all of a sudden Tiff's like, hey, the dishwasher guy is coming and the beer lines cleaner is coming and the hood cleaner, like all these people are all coming like 3 days from now. You need to get all your wires out of there. That I had like mapped. I had drawn a map and I had laid out like all the, I had like stretched all these Ethernet cables. I called a couple of new wires to run. I wanted to have some spares along the key lines and some new wires to hardwire to replace Dante, to hardwire some of the audio signals with these Cat 6 to XLR breakout box kind of things that just run it just over the physical wires. No digital stuff. Just literally just like a, run the XLR pins over the Cat 6 twisted pairs. And so I had all these wires everywhere, and it's like, oh, I have to get these off of all these countertops now. And then once all these service people come in and once we start like opening and loading stuff in and everything, once there's a bunch of stuff on all the shelves and things start getting set up, it becomes very difficult to run some of these wires. So I'm like, oh, I don't have time for most of this. So I had to kind of, cut some scope here and there, and I had to just kind of go over there like in an emergency a few days ago and just emergency run a bunch of cables and just do the best I could in like 2 half days that I was able to be there, and that was it. So I have the cables run like through all the difficult areas. At the ends they're just like coiled up and tied together so I can do the rest later, but I have some of the project done. And it's been a journey, like getting all this done like in the last week or so. Oh, I also launched Transcripts and Overcast and Beta today. That was the whole thing. we'll get to that later. But that's, yeah. So it's been a couple of weeks.
I can imagine. All right, well, we'll talk about that later. And speaking of, we have a lot to cover, so we're just going to plow right into follow-up. And I will start, I don't know, Marco, if you choose to dub in We Are the Champions. Can we use that outside of the context of the Mac Pro? I think we can.
I don't know. But
you're welcome, world, because we have apparently caused Apple, just us, nobody else, has caused Apple to ship a more sane workouts app in watchOS 26.4. I haven't actually tried this myself, but allegedly in the new version of watchOS, you can actually press on a workout type to start that workout. You don't have to wait for the stupid animation, for the stupid play button to show up. You can actually just hit the giant green thing that says, you know, like traditional strength training or whatever, or outdoor run or what have you. Allegedly, that is now fixed. You're welcome, world.
Yeah, that's very promising. Also, a couple of quick notes. When I was last ranting about the workout app, I mentioned that I wish they had some smarter settings around like reminding you to unpause workouts when you when you start moving again. This actually is a built-in feature. They do have reminders automatically to remind you to pause a workout if you've like stopped moving for a while, and to unpause it. And in fact, there's even a feature where it will try to automatically pause and unpause it when you start, you know, if you like stop in a run and then you resume again, it will actually try to remind you. What I found though is that those are, first of all, very annoying. Like if you're actually on a run, I have used those and I have found them to be just so aggressive of just like if you stop for a second, like if you stop like at an intersection. Tap, tap, you want to pause your workout? Like, no, I'm going to be here for 8 seconds. Like, no. So I don't like those for that. But then also I found that in walking workouts, they tend to be a lot less accurate. And I don't know if they're just looking for bigger changes in speed that maybe, you know, they're obviously optimized for running. And maybe just walking is not like a big enough difference between moving and not moving that it triggers it as reliably. So I have not found the current implementation of those to be very good. I've also not, it also doesn't address things like, you know, ability to undo a bad GPS point or undo a missed save. There is, however, at least a setting that I turned on that will allow you to, the end workout button, there's an option to have it prompt you before it officially ends with a confirmation step. So it makes it two steps. You have to tap end, and then it shows up a modal saying, do you want to end the workout? And then you actually hit like a second X to do it. So that helps accidental endings become less likely. But it still needs a lot of just kind of polish. Like there's what we like about Apple, what got us all to Apple in the first place was lots of little smart design and lots of little delights throughout much of their user interface and many of their features of their software and hardware. And the Apple Watch seems to have like none of that. Like it just seems like the Apple Watch was designed in a very rigid way to have exactly these features, nothing else. And again, part of that was, you know, for hardware constraint reasons that were very good reasons. But so many of those kind of like little nice delights of like, oh, that was smart and I needed that. Thank you. Those things seem to be mostly missing on watchOS. And so the workout app is one example of many where like there's a lot of room for that, and I wish they would add more of it. What they have is a nice start, but considering we're like, 11 years into the Apple Watch platform, something like that, it could be a lot better. So I hope it continues to get better. But this is a good start.
All right, let's enter Formula One corner for hopefully just a couple of minutes.
Do Formula One tracks have corners, or are they all like rounded?
They sure do have corners, although I think you can come up with a better name for this instead of calling it Formula One Apex.
One Curve?
I don't know. I don't know enough Formula One terms to come up with something good.
We'll workshop it. But anyways, first of all, I wanted to very briefly spoil this past Sunday's China Grand Prix and say that this really so far is a very interesting season to start watching Formula One. To briefly recap, there's all new rules, all new regulations. The cars are totally different. And my favorite team, McLaren, they have two drivers, as every team does. And neither of their drivers made it to the starting line this last race, which stank. But I'm going to claim that left the space for a very interesting podium. So the winner of the race is a 19-year-old who races for Mercedes. His teammate was, I believe, second. And then former Mercedes superstar now at Ferrari, who has not done anything good in the last season or two, Lewis Hamilton, arguably the greatest of all time, potentially, I think by wins, he is the greatest of all time, was also on the podium. And it made for a really adorable moment where you have these two actual, you know, current Mercedes drivers and a former Mercedes driver, and they're the race engineer for the winner, which is basically the dude on the other end of the radio, was formerly Lewis Hamilton's race engineer. And so, you know, it was a really, really lovely podium, even though my particular team didn't even make it. And so, again, really good time to pick up Formula One if you're at all interested. But that I will stop trying to sell it. I'll stop being a shill at this point. With regard to follow-up, we have a little bit of information about cameras. John and I got ourselves wrapped around the axle with regard to cameras when we talked about it last week. Matt Rigby writes, in the TV broadcast, I'd say that onboard cameras are perhaps 15% of the coverage at most, and they mostly use the track-mounted cameras like any other sport, which is exactly true. I should have made that more plain when we were talking about it. But again, you know, you can choose, if you'd like, to view other cameras. A account that goes by the name The Racing Line, if an onboard camera fails during a race, then no action is taken. The only time an onboard camera failure has had a direct impact on a race was the 1995 Italian Grand Prix. Ferrari was leading first and second when Gene Alessi's, I hope I have that right, camera detached from the lead car and hit Gerard Berger in the second car, breaking the suspension. Whoopsie-dipsies. Alessi's leading car broke down a lap later with an unrelated wheel bearing failure. Ferrari throwing away race wins is a constant in F1 history, can confirm. The Racing Line pointed us to a really great about 10-minute YouTube overview of all the cameras in the car, of which I think there's 7 or 8 or something like that, the video said. It's very, very interesting. Very cool stuff. Additionally, something I should have talked about when we were discussing cameras and whatnot, Eric Fox reminded me that one thing you didn't mention was that the other two might find interesting, as in Marco and John, for follow-up, is how the driver feeds also give you access to their radio communications with their respective teams. Of course, the best radio messages, read the whiniest, get put on the main broadcast, which is true, and I don't think I mentioned that at all, and that's a really great point from Eric, and that can be very fascinating. Normally, it's not that interesting, but it can be fascinating. And then finally, with regard to F1, Brendan Webb writes, I'm not sure why Apple hides the Sky Sports replays on the main navigation, but you can search for Sky Sports China or whatever race you're looking for, and they magically appear. So I should have set a little context. I had said in the last episode that as far as I could tell, at least in replays, there's no way to get the Sky Sports feed, which is mostly about the commentators. I like the Sky Sports commentators. I find them to be egregiously UK biased. You know, Lewis Hamilton and George Russell, you know, and Lando Norris can never put any foot wrong anywhere for any time. And that's, I mean, hi, I'm American. I know how that goes. But it gets to be a little much from time to time. Well, anyways, a lot of people prefer it because that's what F1 used to, or excuse me, that's what ESPN used to broadcast. Well, apparently, instead of just using it as like a different audio track, which I think is all it really is, Apple treats it as an entirely different broadcast. But I think the only way I've been able to find it is exactly what Brendan says. You have to actually search for Sky Sports whatever in order to find it, which, again, is just bananas to me. I really think that Apple does have a lot of potential here for F1 coverage and being, you know, the American partner for F1 coverage. But golly, it's been slow out of the gate. But what are you going to do? All right, let's talk Rosetta. Colin McKellar writes, with regard to processor emulation and how long it lasts, I did some Wikipedia diving and put together this post about how long Apple's processor emulation lasts on the Mac. This looks like a 3-mile-long post, but it's actually a bunch of charts and stuff. It's pretty good stuff. And John, I think you've extracted some stuff, which we'll talk about in a second.
That's Colin continuing here.
Yeah, so Colin continues and writes, in short, 68K emulation was supported on PowerPC for as long as classic macOS existed, including when it lived on as the classic environment in macOS 10. PowerPC emulation, the original Rosetta, was around for 5.5 years after Mac's transition to Intel. According to Apple's present plans, Rosetta 2 will last about 18 months longer than Rosetta 1.
Yeah, and then I pulled out some more interesting info from this post, which is how long each architecture was the current architecture for the Mac. So 68K was the architecture for the Mac for 10 years and 7 months. PowerPC for 11 years and 8 months, and Intel for 14 years and 4 months. And so far, Apple Silicon has just been 5 years and 4 months. So Intel, the Mac has been Intel longer than any other processor. And maybe that's why I feel like even though they're, according to these stats, it's going to be 18 months longer than Rosetta 1 lasted, it just feels shorter because Intel has been around so long. Maybe it's just because of the prevalence of Intel software. Like, going to Intel opened up this whole new world of stuff that became easier to compile for Darwin, essentially. But yeah, it's you know, my recollection of 68K to PowerPC is basically what they said. Like, it basically never went away. It didn't go away until classic macOS went away. Even then, it was the classic environment inside macOS 10. But PowerPC to Intel, PowerPC didn't stick around that long at all. The other thing was Intel was so much faster than PowerPC, and I guess that's also true of Apple Silicon with Intel. So anyway, it really is just a feel thing. Like, it just feels like it's a little bit too soon because circumstances are different, but it will in fact be 18 months longer than one of their transitions, but shorter than the other.
Then related, Tom Obarski writes, on Reddit, I saw that a user received a pop-up warning of upcoming deprecation from a fresh install of Final Cut Pro non-subscription on a brand new MacBook Neo. That's something else. And so we'll put a link to the Reddit post, but the little notification reads, support ending for Intel-based apps. This version of Final Cut Pro will not open in a future release of macOS. Learn how to update on to an Apple Silicon version.
Cool. That's a terrible message because I'm assuming it's not Final Cut Pro is not the problem. Anyway, you can keep reading.
Yeah, so Tom continues, there's some speculation as to whether this is because the A18 Pro is not seen as an M chip and therefore is assumed it must be Intel, or whether a component within an FX library could still be flagged as Intel and thus would invalidate the whole install. Weird edge case, to say the least. If I were to guess, you know, hi, this is Casey. If I were to guess, I would say that it's probably a library or something like that. But I mean, I don't think that the A18 not being seen as an M chip is definitely wrong. It's plausible for sure.
I don't think that's very plausible. I mean, there's a bunch of ways to look up the architecture, and they, you know, the answer is it ARM or is it not ARM? And the A18 Pro is very clearly ARM. If you were to look it up on a phone that ran it, I think the answer would come back as ARM. So
no, that's true.
I think it's got to be a library or a plugin or something. And speaking of that, I don't have the notes, but Apple just bought whatever that that Final Cut Pro plugin company.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I do wonder if they're, you know, the best way to make sure that any Intel-only plugins are no longer Intel-only. Just buy the company and make sure they're all Apple Silicon before the deadline.
All right. Some teardowns have been released recently. The iPhone 17e has an iFixit teardown. We'll put a link in the show notes. And it appears that a lot of the parts are the same as we saw in the 16.
Yeah. Interestingly, one of the things they pointed out is that, say you've got a 16e and you wish it had MagSafe, you can just put the 17e back on there with MagSafe. and it mostly works. Like, so there's a few points, like it doesn't, so MagSafe will attach to it and charge it, but you don't get the little like animation. Little circle filling thing or whatever. It's because like there's a little, it's a little bit of a Franken phone, right? It's not.
So to be clear, so the 16E did support Qi charging, MagSafe officially.
Right, but the animation that you get for MagSafe is the green ring that appears or whatever, but it will charge it. So anyway, many parts are, I think basically every part is the same except for the logic board or whatever, and they made a phone out of a mixture of a whole bunch of parts. They were very excited about the part interchangeability and the fact that they didn't get hassled by the software for like parts pairing and stuff like that. But 17E is just a 16E with a different logic board and a different SoC and a magnet on the back.
All right, let's talk about MacBook Neo. First of all, Gruber had a post with regard to the on-camera and also mic on-screen indicators. And Gruber linked to Apple's platform security guide, which states the MacBook Neo combines system software and dedicated silicon elements within the A18 Pro to provide additional security for the camera feed. The architecture is designed to prevent any untrusted software, even with root or kernel privileges in macOS, from engaging the camera without also visibly lighting the on-screen camera indicator light.
And the context here is that the MacBook Neo doesn't have a little green LED next to its front-facing camera like all the other MacBooks do. Instead, they have an icon in the menu bar, like the green little like FaceTimey icon, and also like a green dot in the corner of the screen. And that dot is basically a stand-in for the light. And last time we mentioned, I'm sure Apple has done something to try to make that more secure, but it's obviously more difficult when you're trying to secure software versus trying to secure it in hardware, where in theory the LED, if the camera is on, the LED is on, because it's like electrically hardwired connected to it, and you'd have to stop that from happening. You'd have to get physical access to the laptop and cut a trace somewhere to prevent that from working. And even that might be difficult. Although there was a bug with that. I couldn't find this link, but the first time Apple did this, they tried to say, and the light will always be on as long as the camera's on, and they messed up the implementation, but that was a while ago. The current implementation is pretty solid, but that's all in hardware. So what do they do to try to make the software more secure? So this first bit from Gruber is there from Apple's security document saying, even if someone puts a rootkit on your machine. They have super user privileges. They have root kernel level access to your Mac. Still, they can't stop that green dot from appearing in the corner.
Indeed. So Gruber got talking with friend of the show, Guy Rambo, and Guy wrote to Gruber, the software-based camera indicator light in the MacBook Neo runs in the secure exclave part of the chip. So it is almost as secure as the hardware indicator light. It runs in a privileged environment separate from the kernel and blits the light directly into the screen hardware. All of that applies to the mic indicator as well, which is a bonus compared to the camera-only hardware indicator. And then Guy also provided a little footnote. Exclaves run on a completely isolated real-time operating system that communicates with the kernel in user space using a very limited API surface, not to be confused with the secure enclave, which is a totally different thing.
Yeah, so to actually stop the light from working, they need more than just access, kernel level access. They need to hack the exclave, which is a lot harder to do because it is very limited. It is a whole separate thing running a whole separate operating system, and it talks to the main operating system, but it doesn't go through the main operating system, it seems like, to get those dots onto the screen. It just does write them directly into the video hardware, old school style. So that's pretty cool.
Yep. And then also Gruber linked to Random Augustine's post about the Apple exclaves, which you can read over on Medium if you can hold your nose to long enough to read something on Medium. All right.
Hey, do you want to log into Medium?
Oh, God, it's the worst. CPU benchmarks. Apparently, we got something a little bit wrong. John, can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, the iPhone 16 Pro Max with the A18 Pro, which is what I was using for CPU benchmarks because the Neo had not been released to anybody yet, has 46% higher single core in Geekbench, not 30%. I just plain did the math wrong. So it was 3428 versus 2347, and I think those are the numbers from the earlier episode, but I just didn't do the math right. So 46% faster in single core, not 30, thanks to Philip Summer for the correction.
Then with regard to SSD benchmarks, Vito Trano writes, your MacBook Neo SSD benchmark figures in the last episode came from the Verge's benchmarks, which only measured sequential speeds. While those are important for large file transfers, random speeds are a better reflection of using the computer, you know, OS boot, logging in, launching apps, etc. Sequential speeds may be more visible to the user in Finder progress bars, but random speeds are arguably more important to the user experience, contributing to the feeling of snappiness and ultimately the longevity of the machine. This seems to me to be a far more important metric for the target market of the Neo. I would agree with that.
Well, before we go on, so obviously the Neo has an SSD and not a spinning disk. Back when spinning disks existed, random access versus sequential access was a key way to measure performance because, as Vito noted, you're doing random access when you're doing most stuff. You're mostly not just copying one giant file from location A to location B, although even that could be random, depending on fragmentation on a spinning disk or whatever. But spinning disks had to move actual disk heads on an arm to get to the track where the data was, wait for the arm to settle, wait for the sector that you want to spin underneath the heads of the track, and then do that all over again, back and forth and back and forth, making all those lovely noises that we remember from the spinning disk days. And so random seeks on a spinning disk were murder, because you spend most of your time waiting for physical items to travel to be aligned and settled, and then a brief reading of some magnetic information, and then you start the whole process over again. Most of your time was burned on overhead. SSDs, on the other hand, do not have any moving parts in that way. They don't have arms that move. They don't have disks that spin. They never have to wait for an arm to move to a different section of a disk, and they never have to wait for a disk to rotate several more degrees, and they never have to wait for the things to settle. And so you would think, well, isn't random access on an SSD basically a constant time operation? Like, it doesn't vary. It doesn't care if you're reading address 0 or address 4 million. It's all just chips. Well, there are things that can affect random access because the chips have to be read in certain size chunks from certain regions at a time and so on and so forth. But so that's why you still do random tests on SSDs. But the difference between random and sequential is not nearly as pronounced as it used to be. And what most people feel like they're waiting around, when do you feel like you're waiting around for a disk? It's when you're copying a big file and you see a big progress bar. Like, if you're copying some huge movie from one disk to another or whatever, if you're not limited by your internet download speed or you're not limited by the other disk, especially now that with APFS that you get the clones, like when you duplicate a gigantic file in APFS, it's like instant, right? Because it doesn't actually copy the data. So that is entirely eliminated, but copying to and from multiple volumes or to and from multiple, physical disk mechanisms, that's when people say, oh, shouldn't this be going faster? It's two SSDs. And that's where you'll see the difference. So I agree that random and sequential are not are two separate things, but I really think that the reason people show sequential is, well, first of all, it's the number that's going up. So it's fun to show in benchmarks. Look how much faster it is. And then also, I think that these days with SSDs, that's the main time people feel like they're waiting. Like, I wish my SSD was faster because I'm copying this giant video file from this external SSD to my internal one, and I'm looking at a progress bar, and I'm looking at my watch.
All right. So Vito continues, I've only found random seek benchmarks in one review, which is Andrew Mark David's review at 11 minutes, 17 seconds. We'll put a timestamp link in the show notes. But the random speeds seem to be on par with what we've seen from the M1 MacBook Air. They also, from what I can tell, don't seem to be to differ much across the entire Apple Silicon lineup.
So I looked at that, and I think they do differ across the Apple Silicon lineup. So we'll put a link in the show notes to the benchmark app, which I had never heard of, but you can download and try it if you want. And then I graphed the numbers for the RND 4K QD 64 read and write and RND 4K QD 1 read. I don't know what that means. I'm assuming random 4K, but I don't know what the QD means. But anyway, two different read and write benchmarks for three machines, the MacBook Neo 256, the M1 MacBook Air 256, and the M5 MacBook Pro 512. And especially on the RND 4K QD 64 read and write tests, the MacBook Pro is way faster. It's like twice as fast in these random seeks as the Neo. So I wouldn't say that the random, they're all about the same. I mean, granted, when you get down to the whatever the RND 4K QD 1 write one, maybe they're a little bit closer, but look at those graphs. I'm going to say there's still a appreciable measured difference between the fastest and the slowest. So, for example, I don't know what these numbers are, but they come from the disk benchmarks. But the Neo is 582, and the M5 MacBook Pro is 1,180. That's close to double. And similarly, on the other, like the closest benchmark is 31 to 45. Still a somewhat substantial difference. So, yeah. I agree that people should be still testing random, not just testing sequential, but I think just people, especially in this YouTube, I complain about this all the time because my entire childhood was spent arguing about benchmarks. Nobody argues about benchmarks anymore. We just YouTubers just use Geekbench and are like, well, the number says what the number says, and nobody. So I applaud Vito to be out there saying these benchmarks are BS. You're just measuring sequential. There's much more to the story. I agree, and there's much more to the story than random. It's like, well, random, I don't care about your benchmark. Your benchmark has this problem. We need to test the launching of Photoshop, but not that version of Photoshop. And yeah. That's the culture I come from, so I applaud Vito for calling it out here. But I will say that I think random access still differs between the less expensive and more expensive SSD MacBook Pros or MacBooks.
All right, John, you went on a field trip?
Yeah, I was happened to be in the mall. I took the trip to the mall. I was driving my son there to get his hair cut, and the reason I drove him is so I could go to the Apple Store. I went to the Apple Store to look at all the new stuff. And I went right to the MacBook Neos. And I don't know what I was expecting. Like, I had this image in my head of the product. Obviously, I'd seen it on Apple's website, and we talked about it on the show, and I knew all these things about it. I didn't go in with any expectations. Like, I'm just going to go in and look at them, and they're going to be exactly like how I thought they would be. And they weren't. I picked it up and played with it and touched it, and I'm like, they have pulled off something with this product that is tricky to do, which is, I mean, think about the laptops. What are they? They're like flat rectangles made of metal, especially when they're closed and you're not using them. Like, what is there to the flat rectangle made? How many flat rectangles made of metal has Apple made since the unibody laptops started all those years ago? Just so many of them. Surely they're all the same at this point. Is there any room within the flat plank of aluminum to do anything, literally? And I think there is, because they've turned, I mean, I don't know if they did this on purpose or whatever, but like one of the things that separates the Neo from its more expensive brethren is, and we'll get to this in a little bit, the screen part of it is not as skinny as it is on the other models because it's more expensive to make them thin, I guess, right? It's a little bit fatter in the screen part. It's a little bit fatter overall, like a millimeter. And one of the things you can do when the screen part is a little bit fatter than it might be on like the old MacBook Air that came to like a really sharp, like the M1 MacBook Air comes to a really sharp point at the part that you pick up, like the lid, you know, the screen lid. One of the things you can do when it's a little bit thicker is you can put a bigger corner radius on all of the corners. And I think, and also, by the way, this the Neo is, I forget the exact measurements, maybe like a quarter inch, a half an inch less wide and deep. You know what I mean? Like if you put this on top of an M5 MacBook Pro, you'd see the M5 MacBook Pro sticking out around the edges because this is smaller. So this is a little bit smaller, and it has a bigger corner radius on all the corners. And the result of that is picking this thing up and just handling it as a thing that you tuck it under your arm and carry it to your, you know, I don't know, to the library or to your class or whatever. It feels so good and so solid and so friendly in a way that the more professional laptops do not, because the more professional laptops are sharper. They're thinner a little bit, but they're also sharper, like literally sharper on the edges, because that's just the way they're designed. Rounding this thing over makes it feel pleasant and solid and friendly and approachable. And I know this sounds so dumb. It's like it's a rectangle of aluminum. How friendly and approachable is an extra, you know, millimeter? I'm telling you, this was my impression upon picking it up. I'm like, oh, this thing feels great. And it feels great in the same way. The only analogy I can have is like the iMac G4 with the little like the metal arm with the floating LCD display on it. Remember that one? That arm looked and felt so good on that machine that you were like, I can't believe that if I pay this amount of money, I get this. And that's the impression I got from the Neo, that like this thing feels like you're getting more than you paid for. You're getting more than your money's worth. It feels solid and expensive and nice in a way that I did not expect it to. I don't know if I expected it to feel janky or something, but it like, I know going on about this, and you're like, so it had rounded corners and you were wowed by that. Who cares? this is my impression, that they really knocked it out of the park, that it feels solid. And the second part of this is the trackpad, which I did know going in. I was thinking, this trackpad's going to be a little bit janky. Nope. It's great. Like, maybe it will get bad over time. I don't know. This is a floor model. And like the first day it came out or the first week it came out, feels so good. I pressed everywhere on that thing. It is pleasant and easy to click everywhere on the thing, and it doesn't feel loosey-goosey and wiggly and tilty. It feels great. So I think if you got somebody one of the a MacBook Neo, they are going to be so happy, especially if they've never had a Mac before and they've only had PC laptops. Oh my God, this is so much better than I thought it was going to be in terms of fit and finish. And I don't know why I had these doubts in my mind, but I was blown away by it. And obviously, it's still got 8 gigs of RAM and a bad screen and blah, 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 but it's like, it's $600. So MacBook Neo, I think they knocked it out of the park with this machine.
So coincidentally, I happened to also go into an Apple store yesterday. And also with the goal of like, oh, like I was walking past it. I'm like, oh, I should go in and check out all this new stuff. And the first thing I did was walk over to the MacBook Neo. And I must have looked very strange to the staff, because I was basically like fondling it like at different edges, like trying to figure out like at what point is this going to feel cheap? And nowhere. I did not find that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it, so I was going over all the corners, all of the like the rounded edges, the sharp edges, the finished. I as I often do in Apple stores with, you know, picking up new products, I closed it and I moved it around. And I'm like, what does the bottom look like? What are the feet? Are the feet worse?
I love even the feet. The feet on the MacBook Air are sharp little cylinders. Like they're not domes like they were on the M1 MacBook Air. The current M2, M3, M4 MacBook Air, the feet are kind of like sharp edge cylinders. The feet on the Neo are rounded and friendly with flat bottoms. Amazing.
Yeah. Like I move my hands over every inch of that thing. And I open it up. I felt even like the screen, like the interior screen hinge, like the, like above the keyboard. I even felt that, like, where is the sharp edge? Where is the sign of cheap manufacturing? I could not find one. It just feels like any other Apple laptop. Like I forget who it was, but somebody, I think on Mastodon somewhere, said a few days ago, like, oh, you can tell there's like a different, there's like a not as good of a grain pattern. I looked, I couldn't tell. I ran my hands over the flat parts. Does it feel different? No, it doesn't. I picked it up, moved it around. Is the weight balance off? Does it feel less solid? No. It just feels and looks great. I was shocked. I really thought there would be some kind of like noticeable lower quality level about it compared to the MacBook Pro and MacBook Air. There isn't. Like I was not able to find one, at least in the Apple Store, with a good minutes of it.
Actually, I hope they take some of these decisions and bring them to the MacBook Pro. I'm not saying they need to make it as rounded as this. Like, I do like the thin lid on the MacBook Air, MacBook Pro, stuff like that. But like, some of these decisions are just, they're not more costly. In fact, they save money, but they're just better decisions. Like, at various times we have complained on this show about exactly how sharp certain edges are on Apple's laptops. And I think the Neo shows that if you're willing to round things over a little bit more, it makes for a more pleasant to handle machine. It also helps that this is smaller. And it does look like a little baby, because it's not like 11-inch MacBook Air size. It's not, you know, the MacBook, adorable MacBook One size, although that was very sharp as well. But the fact that it is a little bit smaller, I think, is going to make it even more attractive to somebody who doesn't want to spend $2,000 on a laptop. They just want a nice laptop and not spend too much money. And this, boy, is this a nice laptop without spending too much money.
Yeah, I was blown away. And of course, I opened it up and I did similar tests as John. Like, knowing how the trackpad works, I was not only clicking the trackpad, but also I tried to click it like on the corners, on the edges. Like, does it feel bad if you click like diagonally from a corner? No.
Because it used to. Like, I have some MacBook Pros with mechanical clicking trackpads that did not feel good. And this does not have any of those problems.
Yeah. I was shocked. And of course, you know, opening up apps, and I even tried like the keyboard, and I was like, oh, the keyboard feels a little bit, I thought it felt like a little bit squishier, but then I went over to a MacBook Pro to compare, and that felt exactly the same thing. Like, no, that's, yeah. that must be just in my head.
I think it's like the same keyboard mechanism. So
yeah, it felt like it. The only other thing I'll note is that like the on the colors, I thought they all looked pretty good. The yellow and the pink were more pale than I expected. My favorite color was actually the blue. I thought the blue would be a lot closer to the MacBook Air midnight color, which is so dark it's almost black. It's way lighter than the MacBook Air. And it's not a light blue. It's still like a dark blue, but it's more like a denim jeans color.
Yeah, like jeans color, yeah.
Yeah, and I really thought the blue Neo was a really nice-looking computer. And if I were to need one of these, which I don't, but if I were to need one of these, I would almost certainly go with the blue. But I also respect people going for the yellow because it's a really fun color. But the blue is a little more my style. But I was blown away both from sheer pride in this platform of the Mac that I love so much, that so many more people are going to be joining us. It's going to be like finally like all the people who weren't able to afford the other Macs, like, we're bringing more people into the fold. That's a great thing for the platform, as I said. It also made me feel so impressed by both Apple's hardware prowess and also just how great computers are right now, that everything the MacBook Neo can do, all of the like high-end pro apps that like it can run. It might not be as fast as everything else, but like it can do it. Your iPhone in your pocket can also do that. What a time to be in computers. Like, yeah, it's not all roses. There are some problems that we need to work out. That's always going to be the case. It always has been the case. But wow, what an amazing time we are in for hardware, that not only is it possible to make a laptop like that that is that good for that price. And it's not like Apple's like not taking any profit on this. You know Apple doesn't do that. You know they're making 20 or 30% at least margins on this thing. To also have all that power in our pockets all the time is an incredible resource. Like, we have amazing supercomputers available to us all the time. That is, and for not even that much money, like, that's wonderful. And I think this product is a hit. And I think this is like, when you look at what PCs do in this price range, Apple's going to kick their butts. And they honestly could use the butt kicking. So this is just fantastic. I'm blown away by how good the MacBook Neo was. I also briefly got to handle the iPhone 17e. It feels great in the hand. It's just like, you know, just like the 16e. Like, you feel it and you're like, wow, that's really light. That's awesome. Do I want it? No. But it's great for people who want it. And I walked right out the store and I didn't even realize until today I totally forgot to even look for the studio displays. Whoops.
Oh, come on.
I was so blown away by the Neo. I was like, all right, you know, mission accomplished. I'm out of here. Walk right out.
I didn't forget. I looked at the Studio Display XDR, although unlike a Casey store, they had these back-to-back, so I couldn't see them at the same time.
Oh, that's sweet.
Not that I needed to, but I played with all the settings on it. I was looking for the thing that lets you pick between like the reference mode and whatever, and I couldn't find it in my brief looking there, but I honestly didn't know where to look. I didn't see it in the displays thing. There's two problems. The Apple Store is really bright, so it's really tough for even 2,000 nits to show, you know, because the ambient light sensor is going to put the monitor already at pretty high brightness. So the best you're going to get is like 2x, because if the monitor is at 1,000 nits and the HDR is 2,000, it looks less impressive than if the monitor is at like 300 nits because you're in a dim room and then the HDR comes on at 2,000. But anyway, their sample photos in the Photos app didn't really show off HDR that well, so you'd be forgiven, Casey, for not being able to see
what's going on.
They also didn't have it in the mode. They had it in P3, like the display profile. They didn't have it in the combined P3 and Adobe RGB mode. I switched it to that mode, and then the screen blinked, and then it blinked again, and it had switched itself back. I'm like, well, there's some bugs. And then I switched it back into the mode again. Eventually, I got it to stick. I couldn't see any difference, but it was interesting that wasn't the default mode for the stuff. But otherwise, it looks like a Studio Display, but it has better black levels, and it's brighter.
Yeah,
cool. It costs twice as much.
Yeah. I mean, did you notice the refresh rate at all, like when you were scrolling a web page?
I mean,
something?
I could tell it's 120 hertz for scrolling stuff, but I didn't, like, that's why, I put it in adaptive, but I didn't know how to really test that. But yeah, it's high refresh. It's a good monitor. The only thing it has going against it is it's not 32 inches and 6K. But everything else about it is very good.
No, the only thing it has going against it is that it's $3,000, whatever the heck the price is.
I mean, proportionally, given the difference in size and pixels, that's not actually that bad compared to the Pro Display XDR.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about MacBook Neo teardowns. First of all, Tech Renew did one where they did fast forward a bit, but effectively they tore the whole thing down in 10 minutes. I think we talked about this briefly last week.
It was
last
6
week.
Minutes they had a department.
Oh, okay, there you go. iFixit did a teardown. There's a video as well as a blog post about it. They did some interesting things. They were talking about, hey, how does this weigh what it weighs? In the good way and the bad way, how does it weigh what it does? And so the Neo's bottom case and keyboard is only 8 grams lighter than the MacBook Air's, despite being 6.5% smaller in two-dimensional area, 101.3 square inches versus 95.1 square inches. The Neo's screen and lid is 48 grams heavier than the Air's. And at 86 grams, the metal H that's under the trackpad that assists in, like, the way the trackpad works, that's 7% of the Neo's total weight, which is bananas.
Weight well spent, because that trackpad feels good.
Yeah. And the Neo's full trackpad assembly is almost exactly twice as heavy as the M3 MacBook Airs.
And I would not have guessed that, because you would think, like, oh, the Taptic engine, isn't that going to add weight and everything?
Yeah,
I guess having moving parts and, like, those steel leaf springs in there and the big heavy metal H, it's fascinating that where is the weight? It's in the screen lid and the trackpad.
Metal's heavy.
I can't tell. So it's 8 grams lighter. The bottom case and keyboard is 8 grams lighter, 6.5% smaller. But in their video, they had, like, you couldn't see. They put the stuff on a scale with, like, one of those kitchen scales with a little, like, non-backlit LED readout or LCD readout for the weight. I couldn't read the weight. So I don't know. Is 8 grams lighter at 6.5% smaller? Is that proportional? I need to know the title, the total to do that math. But anyway, that's... They didn't dive too far into it, but I would say that most of the weight difference, the reason the Neo weighs exactly the same as the larger MacBook Air, despite having a smaller battery, is the trackpad weighs twice as much, and the lid of the where the screen is weighs a little more as well.
Righto. With the trackpad, there's a screw in the center of the trackpad mechanism that lets you adjust the force required to activate the membrane switch that triggers a click, which is pretty cool. So
it's not for the user to do. It's if anyone needs to repair it, or if the trackpad ever started feeling wonky or got too loose or got too heavy or whatever, it's nice to know that there's an adjustment screw there. They also did the usual thing of, like, doing whatever scanning thing. Is it a PET scan, CAT scan? I don't know. They're doing some kind of scan that shows the insides of the thing. It's like an X-ray, but, like, they colorize it and everything. And so you can see the speakers. I put in our show notes. You just look at the video, you'll see all the images. But in our show notes here, I'm showing the same speaker from two sides. That's the same speaker from the top and from the bottom. I know in our notes it looks like it's left and right, but that's just the same speaker. So you can see how big the speaker actually is. Everything else in those big black squares that are to the left and the right of the trackpad is not decidedly not speaker. And good old iFixit opens it up, although they did it so fast and a sped up thing that I had to frame by frame to get these screenshots. But they used like essentially a hot knife to cut open those black things. And yes, the speaker is in, I don't know, let's say 1/4 of it. And the rest of it is completely empty air. It's just hollow inside there. And I think I know why. Do you see these pictures here? And the bottom one where that wire is dangling, that's just like laying on top of it. That's not, there's, that wire is not inside there. That's just the wire, like, you know, from the, you see from the top right. Anyway, there's nothing in there. It is empty air, and it is not air that is channeled to like a bass port to try to like have a tuned length of tube to increase. Nope, that's not it at all. It is just plastic, but it is not flat plastic. It is plastic with those little, diagonal ribs for cross bracing and X patterns. Like there's, it's separated into little boxes, and within each box there is an X. All and the box and the X are made of ridges of plastic.
That's for structure.
And then you see the four holes where screws go in. This is what I think these black plastic things are doing, and probably also doing the same thing in the iPad. These black plastic things are essentially stiffness braces, because that square of plastic has nothing to do with the speaker, but is braced in this way and then screwed at four points into the chassis to make it so the corners of the chassis don't twist and bend. It's like for torsional rigidity.
Yep.
It is a mechanical stiffener. That is my theory, and I'm sticking to it unless someone from Apple's design team tells me that's not what this is for. Because they're definitely not air pockets to increase bass, because they wouldn't put those cross bracing in there. That's not the, what the inside of any, you know, bass port ever looks like. But you do put things like that in to stiffen things. So MacBook Neo, and possibly also the iPads as well, although I haven't seen inside their black things, has plastic stiffeners bolted to it to make it so the corners aren't floppy, which is maybe why it feels so expensive.
Yeah, because otherwise, like, if you had, like, battery in there, battery is rigid, and so, you know, you probably wouldn't need to add more stiffeners to that, but in this case, when you don't have enough battery to fill the cavity inside the case, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So that's I think that's a very good theory, especially looking at these. You're right. Like this, you wouldn't design a ported speaker enclosure with that pattern in it.
I can't even tell if that is open to the air, like, because they didn't do a good job of peeling off all the plastic. Like this went by really fast in a few frames. So, but it's just totally separate. Another thing. So we just talked about how you take this thing apart and the battery isn't glued in, it's screwed in or whatever. And there's been some talk about, obviously for repairability, you don't want to deal with glue and stuff like that. But also like, that perhaps this makes it less expensive to assemble. I don't know a lot about assembly, but I'm thinking that 18 screws versus sticky stuff, the sticky stuff might be cheaper to assemble because you just put the sticky stuff on and you slap it in there. Like a machine can do it that much more easily than a machine can do 18 of these tiny, precise screws. But I don't know. Maybe a machine does all of them. Maybe a machine does none of it. But at any rate, 18 tiny screws. And also, this is another thing that may contribute to the weight. The battery in the Neo looks like it's in like a metal frame with flanges, and those flanges are screwed down with 18 screws. And so when you have the sticky stuff, you don't need a metal frame to hold the battery, and then because you're not screwing anything down, the battery itself is literally stuck to the chassis with glue, or in the case of the iPhone, that electrically releasing glue thing. So I think that metal frame adds weight, those 18 screws add weight, and it is much more repairable, but it also might be a little bit heavier and might actually be more expensive to assemble because you got to put in 18 individual screws versus one sticky thing and slap, and you're done.
All right, tell me about these main boards.
Yeah, just to compare, like, what is the MacBook Neo Logic Board compared to the MacBook Air M3 Logic Board? And, I mean, the Neo Logic Board looks more like an iPad Logic Board. It's a skinny little thing. It looks like an extended phone logic board. Or you can compare it to the iPhone 16 Pro, which has the same SoC. And yeah, you can see it's the same SoC, but the iPhone is just massively miniaturized. I think they're just showing two boards. Is that two boards or two sides of the same board? I can't even tell in this iFixit thing. But you can watch the video and see the size comparisons. Suffice it to say that the logic board portion of Apple laptops has just been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking over the decades, and it is now disappearing to the point where now it looks like an iPad logic board, and I wonder if in 5 or 10 years it's going to look like a phone logic board.
Yeah, very well could be. All right, let's do some topics. And the unthinkable happened, particularly to Marco, actually. AirPods Max 2 are out. That is not the AirPods Max with USB-C that came out a few months ago, whenever it was. This is an honest-to-goodness AirPods Max 2. And, John, you get to do a victory lap.
Yeah, it's just a happenstance that I saw this because some listener said... was asking us to do an Ask ATP in the future, which I don't know if we'll do, but it's saying, like, you should list all of your periodic reminders as an after show or a member special or something. And I actually have a reminders category called Far Future, so those things don't get jumbled up. And what do I put in Far Future? Stuff like this. I went to the Far Future saying, I wonder what's in there these days. And the very top item was, check if there's an AirPods Max 2 for the Marco bet, blah, 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 like whatever. And I'm like, you know what? AirPods Max 2 did come out today, so I gathered all the info. In ATP episode 604 at 1 hour, 3 minutes, and 8 seconds, Marco said, after I had said something about the AirPods Max and a revision, said, John, I think you're being optimistic. Yeah, you can make a bet. Add it to your calendar. I don't think there's a chance in hell the AirPods Max will get another update at least for 2 years. I did add it to my calendar, and there it was. And I added to my reminders. There it was in my Far Future reminders. Well, guess what? That was September 12th, 2024. Apple got it just under the line. Although I didn't actually agree to the 2-year bet. I actually agreed to take the bet at 3 years. But either way, I won, and the world gets AirPods Max 2, which are so very different from their predecessor.
Yes, they're very, very different or something.
Yeah, I mean, they're different in the way everybody wanted, because when the one with USB-C came out, you're like, that's it. They just added USB-C. Where's the revision? Yeah, I want one with an H2. Well, guess what?
I mean, so it's very similar in the approach to the Vision Pro update, which is like, all right, here's this product that immediately upon launch, everybody was like, well, this part's good, but these parts really suck. And here we are, like, you know, many years later, and Apple has released the next version of it. And literally all of the problems people have with it are unaddressed. Totally just left exactly the same. And it's like, all right, if you liked what we shipped before, here's an update with essentially a spec bump. Nothing else has been touched. It's like, okay. Now, the difference between the AirPods Max and the Vision Pro is that people buy the AirPods Max, and it's useful, you know, even more than the evening after you get it. Honestly, the AirPods Max, this is not a product for me. Just comfort-wise, they are extremely uncomfortable for me because they are so heavy, and they did nothing to change that. They did nothing to change the clamping force. They did nothing to change the annoying weird case thing that they come with. None of that is different. They didn't change the kind of awkward control scheme on them because they insist on digital crowns and everything they make. You know, there's so many issues with them. They probably do still sound great because the first one sounded great. So that part's probably fine. It is nice that they are matching the many of the features of the newer AirPods that have come out. So that's all great. But if they didn't work for you before, they won't work for you now. If you love the AirPods Max and maybe you have like an older pair where the batteries are starting to wear out and maybe you're annoyed at the lightning cable or whatever, then this is a great time to upgrade if you still want to use them. They are also still very expensive. But I will say I see a lot of these out in the wild. Now, maybe just because, you know, people in New York have a lot of money, but like I see a lot of AirPods Maxes out there, even like especially on young people, like teenagers. I'm like, your parents bought you a $550 pair of headphones. Damn. but I do see them a lot. I do think people are buying them in reasonable numbers. Not enough. You know, I'm sure it's nothing compared to like the AirPods Pro or the regular AirPods, but it does seem like it is a successful product that has a market. I think the price and the physical downsides of it keep that market smaller than it could be, but Apple seems to not care. So for the market that Apple has chosen to stick with for this product and seems to have no interest in trying to expand that market, this is an update. It's not even a great idea. It's just, this is an update. Okay. It takes them from being like embarrassingly far behind the feature lineup to roughly on par with the feature lineup. And it solves nothing else. But, okay, they did an update.
Yeah, so what changed? Well, now we have the H2 in it, which means you get adaptive audio, you get conversation awareness, you get personalized volume, you get live translation, and you get voice isolation. Additionally, you get 1.5 times more effective active noise cancellation. You get a new high dynamic range amplifier for even cleaner audio. You get reduced wireless audio latency for game mode in iOS, macOS, and iPadOS, but you get the same color, same price, same case, same not folding headband thing. Basically, all the same stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's good that they just... That's what everyone wanted. They're like, why doesn't it have the H2? It's kind of like when the Vision Pro came out with the M2 and everything else was on the M3. So it's just a catch-up thing. It should have the H2. It should have had the H2 a long time ago. Now it does, and it's got all the features.
Yeah. All right. Good talk. Marco, you've got some news. Overcast is shipping in beta. Overcast is shipping transcripts. Tell me... what the heck is going on here? Because this sounds pretty freaking great.
All right. So I've been working on this for some time. Apple Podcast launched transcripts probably, a year and a half ago now? Maybe 2 years ago? It's been a while. I knew back then, oh, crap, that's a really good feature. And I'm going to have to do that someday. But how am I going to do that? Apple Podcasts operates at a much larger scale than I do with much more resources, and I just had no idea how I could possibly ever match that. Last summer, with the release of with the beta of iOS 26, Apple launched a new speech transcription API on iOS. They basically opened up the iOS speech model that is used for iOS's built-in transcription of things like when you speak to Siri, it's that model. When you transcribe notes, you know, it's that model. And so what this meant is that it ran on device. It was very optimized and very fast and very lightweight. Now, I've been looking at different ways to do transcription for a little bit before that, especially once OpenAI's Whisper models had come out. That was a game changer in transcription models because the accuracy was so much higher than what had come before. It was shocking how good Whisper was. But the problem with OpenAI Whisper is that it's a really big model. It's really slow. And so it's great for, you know, one person using on their computer or some very specialized app uses. But like for the most part, like it's great if you are transcribing like your own podcast that you make once a week. Whisper is great. But if I was going to try to offer transcripts in Overcast for like all podcasts or many podcasts, that wasn't going to scale. And there are also, you know, if you're operating at a smaller scale, again, like if you have like maybe a podcast hosting company and you wanted to transcribe, you know, audio for your customers that they upload. If you're dealing with, you know, maybe that's hundreds of uploads a week or something, that's a very different scale than what I'd be operating at. So there are things like transcription provider or transcription APIs from the AI providers. So, you know, OpenAI has a transcription API. You know, everyone has stuff like this now. The problem with those is that they're not really designed for podcasts. They usually have audio length limits or size limits that many podcasts would exceed. And just cost-wise, you would be talking about hundreds or thousands of dollars per day at the scale that Overcast would need those to be. And Overcast is not going to take on a thousands of dollars a day API cost. That would be... Let's just say that would require me to raise the price of premium higher than most people would be willing to pay. So what happened last summer is when Apple released their iOS 26 and all the OS 26s, when they all had this new API in them for Apple's on-device transcription model, I ran some tests. And it just blew me away how incredibly fast it was. So one thing I noticed, like on a regular M4, like on a Mac, on an M4. I was running this on my laptop, and it was able, because I wasn't going to put, you know, Tahoe on my main Mac. But so I was doing all this development on my laptop over the summer. And I noticed that, you know, it was able to transcribe. If I ran a few jobs in parallel, I could have one M4 Mac transcribe audio at about 200x the audio's playtime. So in other words, about 200 minutes transcribed for every real-time minute that has passed. So I was like, and that was so much faster than anything else I'd ever tried. In the meantime, by the way, there is a model called Parakeet that NVIDIA released that actually is fairly competitive with this. I have not yet looked at Parakeet, but I intend to in the near future, probably. So I'm working with Apple's transcript model, and I noticed, I'm okay, well, if one Mac can do, like, you know, 200x real time, well, how many podcast minutes are there? Let me see, like, what if I just start transcribe? Let me get, like, a couple of Mac minis and just have them start transcribing the most popular podcasts. How many can they get through? And I have some information of, like, I can see what the most popular podcasts are. I can see how many episodes they release, you know, per month or whatever. And I can do some division and figure out, like, you know, usually I can download a copy of what they serve and I can see how long it is and start analyzing things. I'm like, okay, so let me try. What can a couple of Mac minis do? And I was blown away by how effective that was. And, you know, I'm like, okay, I can't just keep burning these in my house. And let me see what I could do. So just
put them next to the water in the closet. It'll be fine.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I went to Mac Mini Vault, Mac Mini, which is, their actual name is CyberLink. That's the actual company name, but it's Mac Mini Vault. Because what they are, I think they're the only provider where you can like rent a Mac Mini from them for $100 a month. But if you buy it, if you buy your own and mail it to them, then they'll host it in their data center for only $50 a month. And I was like, well, it doesn't take that many months to come out ahead if I'm just buying the base model. Yeah. And it turns out, and I analyzed, by the way, I don't know if listeners might recall, I recently have had strong opinions about the bang for the buck for M4 family chips and what the maximum bang for the buck for processing power is. This is why I did all this analysis last summer. And it turned out the base model Mac Mini was way more bang for the buck for processor performance than any other configuration or any other computer. Okay, great. So I got two Mac Minis and I sent them off to Mac Mini Vault in Wisconsin. Awesome. And I leased one. There's a company called Green Mini Host in the Netherlands. I'm like, if there's certain podcasts that are like EU region locked, that I found a Mac Mini Host in the EU. I think the Netherlands is in the EU. at least in Europe. So I'm like, great, all right. So I had those three, and that was June 27th. And this required me to learn a bunch of stuff. Like, I had to, first of all, I'm installing the Tahoe betas. And every single time there's a new beta, the API changes a little bit, or some limit is imposed, or some limit is released, or some bug is fixed. So all summer, I'm updating these Mac Minis with the betas. And that was another question I had to, like, first ask Mac Mini host. I'm like, Mac Mini Vault, rather. Like, can I run betas on your Mac Minis? Like, is there any reason why I couldn't do that? And no, there's no reason, so it's fine. So I'm running the betas. I'm doing everything via remote desktop, like, you know, like VNC, like to the Mac Minis, like from my home computer. And meanwhile, also doing it all like on my laptop locally and updating that every time. And then update, like, this whole thing, I had to learn how to basically run Mac servers, which is something I really had not done beyond just occasionally having a Mac Mini in my house to be like a NAS or a streaming thing or whatever.
There was just a link that I was going to put in a future episode, but it seems relevant now that let me see if I can find it. There was, like, I think in 26.3 or something, that File Vault now lets you unlock the File Vault encrypted drive over SSH.
Yeah,
like before your thing boots.
That would have been nice.
Yeah. I mean, presumably these hosting companies will do this for you. That's what you're paying them for or whatever. But for people who don't have that, but yeah, apparently we'll put a link in the show notes to the Apple support article that even before the OS boots, when it's just at the thing where it's like, hey, enter your password to unlock this File Vault disk so I can boot the OS, you can apparently SSH in remotely and enter the File Vault password so it will continue with the boot.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've learned so many things about running Macs remotely. Like, you know, all the different, like, I have a big text document of all the things I have to do, you know, for a fresh install, like to prepare it and everything. because, you know, every time there's a software update, I got to do the whole, I got to do all this again, go to all of them. And of course, in the summertime, like during the beta period, it's every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, I'm going and updating all of these, running the tests, like making sure I can still do what I want to do. And meanwhile, I have to also integrate this, you know, this, these three Mac minis into Overcast's infrastructure. So I have to build in a job queue. I have to build in like performance and health monitoring, like from like the Overcast transcription app that I'm running on these Mac minis that integrates with my other performance and health monitoring on the server side. And I have to, you know, build in things like, all right, well, if the Mac mini takes a job and then crashes, then I have to have some kind of like repeat job queue entry to re-queue that after a while and have some other Mac mini handle it. Like, so all of this stuff. And it was such a journey, but it was working. And so I went back to Mac Mini Vault, and I'm like, let me see if I can get any better pricing. And, you know, not really. But so $50 a month was like, you know, what each one would cost me if I bought it up front. And then I was like, okay, this is working out well. I want more coverage. I don't want to just do like the top 100 podcasts. I want to do, you know, anything with more than X followers to it or X subscribers to it. Great. So I got two more Mac Minis in August. So, you know, started out like really, really simple, you know, just the three, like the two that I own and the one I leased in the Netherlands. And then now I'm up to two more, now I'm up to five. And what five could do was great. You know, it was like, okay, all right, now. But, you know, the cost is starting, you know, now I'm, you know, $250 a month plus the 100. Like, it's, you know, it's like, it's starting to get like, okay, this is starting to get to a decent amount of money. And I thought, okay, let's see how the five do. The five, it ramps up pretty much linearly. So, okay, how many more podcasts can I cover? And it was, you know, I'm starting to cover like a somewhat reasonable percentage of popular podcasts. But then I'm like, all right, well, I also want to do like some of the back catalog. Like, can I go back like a few months? Can I go back a few years? Like, how much can I do? And I started thinking, you know, since I don't really need a lot of like help from the host, I'm just running these anywhere, I wonder if there's like a local data center that I can co-locate. Like, if I can get, like, you know, people make these brackets that hold six Mac minis into like a 3U space on a rack. And I'm like, if I can get, let me see, like, what would it cost to host a 3U rack of Mac minis in a data center? You know, because if I can get that for a few hundred bucks a month, then I might, you know, I might be able to come out ahead of what it's going to cost me I was thinking, you know, maybe I'll have like 10 or 12 of these. Like, that could do a lot. If I can, what I was doing with three and then with five, is like, if I can get like 12, like, this could really be something. And so I bought a few more, and I'm like, as I'm doing this, I'm like, let me see, like, here, I'll paste you in the Slack. This is where this went.
Before you send whatever you're going to send, I would just like to say that I am looking forward to the day that I get a shipment from you padded in Mac Minis.
Is packing material when the M5 Mac Minis come out.
All right, so you've sent two photographs that I will describe. One of them is two Mac Minis with little stickies on them that say, what is that, Scribe 1 and 2?
Yeah.
And then a second photograph that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Mac Minis stood kind of upright, if you will, with a Post-it per Mac Mini connected to, I guess that's a UPS of some sort?
No, that's a switch on the left, and that's an old iPad on the right, just basically because, you know, when you run them, they get hot, and I didn't want to melt my rug. And so this Lovely. Was my thermal management
that's
solution.
The one on the right is on the rug, though.
Yeah, well, when you just have one, it's not that bad. But when you have seven, you know, it starts to add up. So this is like, all right, now I have a few more and it's going well. And I'm like, okay, I'm like looking at different data centers, like I want to know, like, you know, what are my situations for, you know, for racking these somewhere. So I got a rack enclosure to see like what it is. And so here's this next photo here. This is six of them in a rack enclosure made for Mac Minis. It's a very simple, you know, just metal bracket. And
it seems like it's a shelf with brackets to mount it on the rack, you know, and very little else. There's not too much here.
Yeah, exactly. And so I started talking to data centers, and
I'm sorry. There are so many Mac Mini boxes on the right hand side of this photograph.
You can build a little fort out of them.
It was really getting ridiculous. Like, because I've now at this point bought 7 Mac Minis, and like it's starting to get. You know, I'm like, do I keep the boxes? Like, what do I do?
Everyone thought it was OpenClaw that was causing the run on the Mac Minis. Really,
yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
No, and for the record, I'm looking at this rack mount, and I don't know if there's a reason behind this or if this is really the right iteration numbers, but I see Scribe 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12.
Well, yeah, because there were already some already in the data centers.
Oh, my word.
So at that point, 1 through 6... were in the data center. Or no, 1 through 5 were in the data centers. 6 was that extra one off to the side of the previous photo. That was just one that I just had. That was like my beach Mac Mini. Like, so that was just, I conscripted it into service for this purpose.
You should start looking on eBay for M4 Mac Minis.
Maybe I'll be supplying them soon. But anyway.
what is your power bill for the month or months that these were all in the house? Holy crap.
Well, so it turns out when you're...
I think all those together are less than my Mac Pro.
Oh, by
far.
That's
probably true.
It's probably less than your monitor. So the combined power usage of 6 Mac Minis doing transcription is something like 250 watts. Because
that's really not bad at all.
They're not doing much GPU work, and they're all just the base model M4, so the top of the power envelope is not that high. It's like about 50-ish watts or 40-ish watts each. It's like 250 for that whole thing. Because I was curious too. I measured it. So that's how I know that. Anyway, so I start talking to data centers, and it was very hard to find any data center that would even take just one guy, because it turns out what I've learned is that most data centers, their business is like big companies or the government, so it's like they don't have not a lot of data centers are willing to talk to one guy. And I found one locally that was, it's on Long Island, and it was willing, they were willing to talk to me. And I was like, all right, so, I'm looking to get, what I need would be at minimum, 3U plus whatever I would need for, network gear or a router or whatever. So, maybe three or 4U of rack space, 300 watts of continuous power usage and whatever you can give me on the internet side. What would that cost? And I learned, basically... that was too small for this data center for any data center to care about. That I've never done anything with data center before, so I had no idea what is it like. I was picturing you just rent space by the rack unit, by the U basically, and I thought I could just ask for 4U and how much will that be? And it turns out it's not worth them dealing with that. What I learned is that the amount of space that we have on Long Island is ample, but power and bandwidth are the expensive parts. And so they're like, okay, well, we can give you maybe half a cabinet, but we mostly just do full cabinets. And I was like what? Like the whole thing, the whole tall rack, 48 or whatever rack use that's in a, I'm like, that's, oh God, okay.
And so
how much is that?
You need another 15 Mac Minis then.
Well, I'm like, this is like, I don't know how much this is going to be a lot to afford. So I'm like, all right, well, that's way above what I can do right now. So I'm like, all right, let me figure something else out. And so for most of the fall, I just ran that rack or that enclosure of the 6 Mac Minis. I had the 6 in the data center, and then I ran these 7 just in my house.
In the water closet, it's calling to you. You know it is. It's the ultimate. It's the ultimate. Forget about the entire server cabinet. You've already got one. It's got water bottles on the bottom, and you just shove this thing in. You close the door.
Well, the good thing, since they're quiet, and since they work as a nice little heater, also, although not much. I mean, a 250-watt space heater is a very small space heater. But I just had them on top of that file cabinet you see on the right there in that picture. I just had them sitting on top of that for all fall, it was just sitting there, just running. And especially because, as I was coming back on the mainland for the school year, I have this perfectly good internet connection over here. It's not going to be used very much all winter, so might as well use it. And so I'm like, all right, if I put 6 of them here, maybe I can put another 6 of them in the restaurant, because the restaurant also has an internet connection that is idle all winter long. I started scaling it up in my mind. I'm like, all right, if I can if I can make this work, like, I can put them all over the place. Like, in I have two houses and a restaurant, and maybe I can, like, send some to Casey or something. Like,
two turntables and a microphone.
Right.
I'm just going to pick up your couch cushions one day, Casey, and there'll be some Mac Minis under there, and it'll scribe 27 and scribe 28. Like, what the hell?
Oh, my word.
There have been in the fall around Black Friday, and there have been a couple times Mac Minis went on significant sales. And I was like, well, if I can get them for, like, I did the math, and I'm like, if I can get them for, like, $500 or less, like, their retail price is $600, but if it was, like, $500 or less, I would look at it. And sometimes you can get them for, like, $450. I'm like, that's getting pretty good. So there were a couple of times where I'm like, I splurged, and I'm like, you know what? If I get six more, I can do a lot more transcripts.
Oh, my word.
And so I would get six more. And that happened a couple of times. It soon became apparent that I was probably ready for the next level. And so I called the data center back.
And I'll take a cabinet.
Yeah, and it turned out a cabinet was not that much once you had like 18 Mac Minis. And so I got myself a data center contract.
Oh, my word.
And I had to learn a lot about how do you host things in a data center. I had never even been inside one. I had never seen one. I was picturing a very different thing than what it was. I was picturing everything like black, dark, like, you know, loud, awful, like a bunch of, you know, people.
It wasn't loud?
It was moderate volume, actually. But
it used to be louder, let's say.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, also, so this data center I found was not like fully, it's not fully occupied yet. It's partially, so there are a lot of, you know, servers and stuff in there, but like, it's not like the room I'm in is like half full. So it's like, okay, great. So I got this contract with this local data center. They were very nice, very helpful, because of course everyone who works in a data center is a nerd like us. So, you know, everyone's very helpful, and I think they were very happy to see a customer who was not just like a boring, you know, bank or something. Things escalated a little bit. Here, I'll send you this other picture. This is me installing the Mac Minis into the rack.
Oh, my word.
Did they
provide networking equipment, or did you provide that?
I provided that. So I'll get to that in a moment. But I will just show you the final state that I have reached is here we go. One more picture here. There we go.
I love the selfie. So it's a picture of Marco with his vaguely Steve Jobs glasses with a DeWalt electric screwdriver and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, what is that, 18 Mac Minis in a rack behind you? Oh, my word.
So I've now reached...
Oh, my God. This is, what, 36 Mac Minis?
And I still have the six that are in the beach house, and the few that are in Mac Mini vault.
Oh my god, problem!
So you use those light up Ubiquiti plugs.
I now have 48 Mac Minis.
Oh my word! You have 48 Mac Minis.
Did you even look at like AWS Graviton ARM? You know, like how much did you price out a cloud based thing for this or no?
Not really. Like, I was looking at APIs from the AI providers and stuff, but like actually do like, so what I like about this setup is it had like the recurring cost is almost nothing. You know, when I build Overcast, I build it for the long haul because I've been around the block. I know like anything I sign up for that's going to be like $3,000 a month, that really adds up. But this entire thing is like $1,000 a month. And I have a lot of headroom. And, you know, I had to pay up front for the Mac Minis, obviously, but they aren't that much expensive. They're not that expensive. And I was able to get most of them on sale whenever they were. I didn't pay that much for this amount of capacity. And each one of these has 16 gigs of RAM, an amazingly capable processor. Now it has professional, you know, full-time networking in a data center, power redundancy and everything. So actually, when I compare the processing power I have at my disposal here versus what I'm paying Akamai for since they bought Linode, like, this destroys anything else I've seen in terms of capability per dollar. This is way better. So I had to learn everything about this. So as you see there, as you mentioned, I have my Ubiquiti light up cables, because of course I got a Ubiquiti light up switch and Ubiquiti router, because I know how to run those. I already have in my Ubiquiti site manager, I already have multiple sites. I have been at the house, at the restaurant. I already manage multiple Ubiquiti sites. I know how to do it. Their equipment is rock solid. So yeah, I did it. It was fine. I had to learn a few other things that were pretty surprising. So number one, I had no idea that power in data centers is 208 volts. Right? You didn't know either, right?
No.
So, you know, US, you know, we have the 110 or the 220 or whatever. It's like, whatever, 208, whatever it is. Like, it's the 220. It's the high voltage. And fortunately, like, all modern computer equipment has universal power supplies that it can take in anything from, like, 100 to 240 or whatever. It has a wide range of the power supply levels. But everything else you have to deal with, like, so another thing I learned is that power at a data center is usually provided with two different inputs. And they were great. They took me on a whole tour of the data center, and I saw, like, the entire infrastructure of the place. There's two of everything. There's, like, two generators. There's two power regulation sides. There's two HVAC sides. Like, there's two of everything for redundancy. And it's a very nice data center. And so everything has to be able to fail over. And when you are connecting to their power, the back of the rack has a whole bunch of plugs. Oh, and by the way, they're not just like the US, you know, NEMA 15 whatever plug. They are the like what you see on the back of a computer, like the, I think it's the, is it the C13 or the C14? They're that. That is what data center plugs are. Here, I'll send this picture. You can see. This is the back of the rack, and the colorful.
I wanted to see how well you did on cable routing.
Yeah, so the colorful plugs you see on the back of the rack, there's a left bank and a right bank, and that's two different power inputs. And so at first I was like, okay, well, I'll just plug into one of them, because, you know, if these are not serving traffic, they're work consumers. So if some go offline for a while, it's not a big deal. Like, the queue will just build up, and then when they come back online, they'll just start working through the queue. But I was like, all right, well, that, you know, I told the guy who's giving me the problem, like, oh, that's because all my stuff only has one input. I don't have redundant power supplies, any of this stuff. And he's like, well, once a year we, like, take down an entire side for, you know, a few hours to test things, and so you don't really want to be plugged into that side during that time, and then, you know, we do the other side. So I'm like, okay, well, how do people solve this problem?
They buy server hardware where they can plug both cables into redundant power supplies.
Well, that too. Or it turns out there's a device called an ATS, an automatic transfer switch. And so you can plug in the ATS into both sides, and then it offers you a single set of outlets that is redundantly powered, basically. So you can plug in all your single-ended stuff into the ATS. And since all of my stuff is single-ended, that's what I did. So I had to learn that. Like, there's so much about this that I just had no idea. Like, this is how servers were, like, physically run.
You're really not taking advantage of this rack. Those Mac Minis are just barely, they're like the size of the faceplate on the old servers. And the whole rest of the rack is just empty space.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of space. Like, you'll notice, like,
yeah, servers are long. Remember how long the X-Serve was, which is probably the only rack mount server you may have been familiar with? They're really long.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing stopping me. If I wanted to, like, I could use both sides of the rack. Like, I could just put a second set of them on the back rack mount holes.
You want the hot side going into the hot aisle. You don't want to be pushing hot air into the middle of your rack.
So yes, technically you are correct. In practice, like, as I walk through the aisles of the data center,
rack minis.
there's some, but, like, in practice, like, I walk past, you know, as I'm walking down the ostensibly cold aisle, some people have installed their servers backwards and are blowing hot air into the cold aisle. So, like, it doesn't seem like it's that, you know, strictly necessary at this scale. And yes, you're right. Like, the Mac Minis are just not producing that much heat. You'll see, like, the big black things I have kind of, like, at top and midway, those are fans. They're rack mount fans that suck air in from the bottom and blow it out the back, because the Mac Minis are just, you know, having the hot air just go straight up.
The Mac Minis are not blowing air out the back of them, unfortunately.
Right. They're just kind of, you know, it's wafting upwards from them. And so these fans suck it in and blow it out the back. But even the, like, I don't think it's that necessary at this scale, obviously, or honestly. But anyway, so I had to learn about 220 volt. I had to learn about ATSs. I'm being billed by, like, sustained kilowatt hour, and by, you know, internet cap bandwidth. So like I have a 2 gigabit connection, I have whatever number of kilowatts, like that's because that's the scarce resource for them is power and bandwidth. I had to learn, you know, they provide the internet via what they call a DIA. And I had to, of course, I'm instantly going to like ChatGPT and Gemini. What the heck is a DIA? How do I connect whatever that is to whatever I have? What should I have? What equipment do I need? What settings do I use? And yeah, they give you like a yellow fiber wire and they're like, here you go. They like I ran it to your cage. Okay. Now what do I do? And I had to like buy like a little fiber transceiver, but it had to be exactly the right kind to go into the SFP port on the Ubiquiti whatever router I got. I think it's the one of the Dream Machine Pro Max Ultra. I don't know. one of the high end rack mount ones. I had to learn all this stuff. Like, and this is, you know, for people who work in data centers, I'm sure this is trivial to you because you've been doing it forever. But like when you've never seen it before. That's all brand new. So I had to do a lot of just learning. And again, thank God for like the AI tools and YouTube tutorials here and there for certain things. I was able to figure it all out eventually. And again, the data center people were very helpful with the parts they could help with. So it was a really great learning experience. I am very, very – it was very fun doing it. Like I don't get a lot of physical projects. And like to be able to like wire up a whole bunch of computers and, you know, run all these network cables bundled together and, you know, have everything all organized. I even like I recently set it up so that like if one of the Mac Minis crashes in a way that I can't reboot it remotely, I can now log into the power thing and remotely just kick off an entire bank of them and like have it power cycle an entire, you know, set of six. So I built a manual kicking machine. And it's a lot of fun. Like it's just, I'm so happy I did this. And what this has enabled is Overcast is now transcribing every podcast that has more than one listener.
Every single one.
Every podcast. Well, there are language restrictions. Because I'm using Apple's API or Apple's, you know, models for this. Their models only support English, French, German, Japanese, Italian, Portuguese, and there's one more. Oh, no, that's it. That's six, yeah. If I actually look at what Overcast top languages are, the one I really want is Dutch. They don't support Dutch yet, and that is one of Overcast's top languages in terms of, like, podcasts being produced that people are listening to. But otherwise, like, that covers most of what most people are listening to. And so, but so not everything, obviously. So among those podcasts that I can support with this API based on the language, I am able to transcribe every episode that comes out, you know, easily catching up every podcast that has more than one listener, that is public. And then I was like, you know, what? I want to do the back catalog. And so I started kind of raising the numbers of like, all right, let me go back again, start out, go back a month, go back 2 months. And then, you know, the you know, jobs in the queue would spike up and then they would slowly churn through them and, you know, slowly work through. And I'm like, okay, that's good. That's getting there. And then I was like, why the number, I'm just not keeping up. Like there was like a couple of weeks where like, I was not able to keep up. I'm like, what is going on here? I bought 48 Mac Minis. Why can I not keep up? By the way, when I said a few episodes ago that I've seen the Tahoe welcome tour a few times.
Oh, gracious.
This is why. I have seen it so many times. Welcome, liquid glass. I would love to never see that screen again. But anyway. And so I was like, what is going on? I built a whole logging feature to see so every server could log every action that was taken on a transcript. It's like, what is going on here? And I found after a little while there was a bug that was causing a lot of the transcript jobs to not be deleted afterwards. So they would recur after a few hours.
Oh, no.
So I fixed the bug, and within a couple hours, the queue went to zero. And I was like, oh, I have more capacity than I thought I had.
Oh, no.
So then I thought, I wonder what it would take to transcribe private podcasts too. Because that's something that Apple Podcast doesn't do. I don't know. The only other apps that have this, I think, are you know, there's like big ones like Spotify, YouTube, but then Pocket Casts has it, but they lock it behind their $40 a year subscription. And honestly, I didn't find it worth $40 a year to give to them to find out how they did it. Maybe that's just me being bad at business, but it just felt gross. Sorry. Just that's how I am. And so I fixed that. After I fixed the bug, I'm like, let me see what I can do with private podcasts. Because wouldn't that be cool if I could do them too? Because really, a private podcast, it's a whole bunch of different feeds. Like, there's like one feed URL per user that subscribes to it. But they're all serving usually the same audio to all of those people. So if I build in the right algorithms to detect, like, is this the same audio, I can just transcribe one of them and have all of those people get it. And so I built that. And it turns out I'm able to support almost all private podcasts too. So now Overcast is transcribing every public podcast with more than one listener. Almost every private podcast, like above a certain, I forget where, I think I set that threshold at something like 10 or something. Like, so if you have a membership that has at least 10 people, something like that, then, you know, in Overcast, then that will be transcribed as well. And all of this is running on these 48 Mac Minis.
Do you really need 48 at this point? I'm not trying to snark. I'm genuinely asking you, like, what do you think is your steady state need if in order to handle the load that you have?
Well, before I fixed the bug that was causing them to repeat themselves, I thought I could never get enough. Now, when I've reached a steady state, I do drop below 100% use. But what I've been doing is just going back more and doing more back catalog work. So I've already, for podcasts that have more than like 100, I think is where I am right now. If you have more than 100 listeners, I think I'm transcribing all of your entire back catalog at this point. If you have, you know, because again, like whenever whenever my queue would hit zero, I would just like lower the threshold. It's like, all right, now go back 5 years, now go back 7 years, now go back 10 years. And every time I would do that, the number of jobs would spike up and then they would slowly churn through them. And they prioritize new releases and they prioritize popular podcasts. So there's not much cost in having the queue be full of a bunch of work to do. But you know, they would eventually, I would catch up at the new level because all of those back catalogs will have been transcribed. And then I just, you know, lower the limits again. And the next thing to do is lower it to podcasts that have one listener. Because right now I'm at, like, if you have two or more listeners, again, more than one listener, that's one thing. But if I go to one listener, then that, like, I think that like doubles the number of podcasts or something that I have to do. So that's its own decent sized jump. But once I'm done with a lot of the back catalog work, I think I will be probably ready for that at this level. Now, I realize, like, you know, I will have a surplus of computational power here before too long. So what do I do with that? And, well, I can start moving work to them, first of all. Like, things like image resizing that I have right now, my main Linux servers at Akamai, there's, you know, they're doing a lot of that kind of work. I can move that to these. Why not? They're super fast. They have all this great stuff. I actually tried earlier in the winter. I tried, like, you know how a lot of podcast apps will use the dominant color in artwork to tint the interface in some way. I tried running that on these, like, where, like, one of the jobs they would do, like, so one thing they do is language detection. And as part of the transcripts, they also do music detection. So that's like they're doing a pretty sophisticated transcript job, you know, with this API and with the music and everything. But then, you know, I was like, well, I can keep farming more work to these things. Now I have all these Mac Minis sitting here. What can they do? As I look into more like smart transcript features, I can do things in the future that I haven't done this yet, but I can do things like, you know, automatic chapter detection or topic detection or summarization, things like that. Well, now I have all this computational power I can do that with. And it's not going to be the same as if I was running, like, you know, ChatGPT's flagship model or Claude's flagship model. Like, it's not that kind of hardware. But it is basically a whole bunch of computational power that will be almost free to operate over time. And so there's a huge incentive for me to move work to them or to find work they can do that would help the product. So I'm not worried about that. I think I will have plenty of work for them to do over time. And also, I had to solve the issue with dynamic ad insertion. So there were a couple of things. Like, as I was making transcripts, I'm like, all right, one thing that I need transcripts to reach a certain minimum level of functionality for me. One of those is like, all right, I definitely want them to be time synced so that, you know, I don't just want a static transcript that just dumps all the text of one version of this, but then the version that you have that has different ads in it doesn't line up. Everything has to line up. And I thought, well, how do I do that? So for a lot of the summer, I spent a lot of the summer just trying, developing and testing different algorithms to basically make signatures of the audio, to analyze the audio to say, all right, where, you know, what kind of waveforms are there, or what kind of frequency pairings or frequency patterns, or like, they, like, I tried all these different algorithms to like somehow characterize what this audio is, so that way when the server transcribes the version that it gets, and then you on your phone download your download of that podcast, but yours has different ads spliced into it, so that, you know, it might not line up or it might have things inserted or removed. I want my transcript generated from the server to line up, to be able to be lined up with what your phone got from its different download of the same podcast. So how do I do that? So I'm looking at all these, I was looking at all these different signature algorithms of like, all right, what, first of all, what can I generate that is fast? And then secondly from that, like, what actually is like a unique way to identify different parts of the audio? And honestly, I got to say, AI was very helpful in this. AI did not write the algorithms for me, but it did tell me what kind, like, it, you know, I was asking AI models last summer, like, how do different companies solve this problem? Like, what do different apps use for this? What kind of approaches are there? And it was like, oh, here's what, you know, Shazam uses for its fingerprinting. Here's how Spotify does theirs. Here's, like, they tried to take some guesses on how YouTube Content ID works. Like, there's all these different things. Like, okay, this actually very helpful. I was able to, over the course of a few months, get a signature algorithm that worked, that was able to read the same file, and I could, like, you know, I was doing tests, I would, like, you know, download something from here, then download something through the Netherlands Mac Mini that I was renting, and like, all right, we have different ads now, compare these, like, can the algorithm find the parts that are the same and line them up correctly, can it detect which parts were inserted or removed, so I can then adjust the transcript in those areas, and it took months, but I finally got there. And between the transcript algorithm and the signature algorithm and the music detection algorithm, all of those things were just barely fast enough to plausibly run on the iPhone. And they all used APIs that were built into the iPhone. So I'm like, wouldn't it be great if I was able to offer on-device transcription for any podcast episodes that I didn't do myself server-side? And so from that point, I was developing the entire pipeline as something that also compiled and ran on iOS. And I'm happy to say I was also able to ship that. So that in the beta today, like, again, not, it's not in the public version yet, it's still beta only, but in the beta today, any podcast that I haven't transcribed, you can just hit transcribe on your iPhone and it'll do it. It might take, like, you know, a good, you know, 3 to 5 minutes, depending on how long it is. And it uses the new background activity API that introduced in iOS 26 for Final Cut exports. It uses that one where, like, you can do, like, the long-running processing task if you start it from the phone or from the app in the foreground, and then it puts the progress in the live activity. So if you have iOS 26, you can transcribe on device too. And critically, if you do that, the transcript you make, if it's a public podcast, will be shared with everybody else as well. Mm-hmm. So it submits that to the service. And if I don't have one that I've generated myself yet, I'll use yours. And so you're making the same transcript. Like, it isn't like the ones you make on your phone are worse than my server ones. They're the same. It's the same models between the Mac and iPhone. It's the same models with the same quality and running, you know, all the same process. So that, I think, is another great feature of this. I got to say, the signatures took the longest by far. And I had to learn all sorts of stuff, too, about, like, long-running Mac processes. you know, obviously memory leaks weren't going to be tolerable, but that was easy to get around or to avoid, rather. But things like, how do I make, like, what do I do if my process crashes? And the answer is LaunchD. Like, you basically have, like, a LaunchD, you know, thing that you create that says, like, just automatically always make sure this app is running, and if it crashes, just open it up again. When I was doing the image color detection that I was saying earlier, like, detect the dominant color in this image, there was a part of that code that kept, like, segfaulting in a really deep part of the Accelerate framework, and I could not figure out why. It seemed like it was actually part of Apple's sample code, and I couldn't – it was so deep in the stack. It was like, I think it's just a bug in the OS about this call that I'm calling. There is no way to avoid this crash. So I learned XPC, and I made it its own little XPC child process so that when the image detection would crash, it wouldn't crash the whole transcription client. Like, I had to learn that. I had to learn things like, you know, Apple Remote Desktop, which is how I right now, this is how I'm managing all these servers, is I have like a setup script, but then, and I can SSH into all of them. So, like, when I update the transcription app, I use a script to just SSH, copy it all over, and relaunch it. But if I have to, like, change Mac settings or things like that, I have to, like, log into the screen of the Mac with Remote Desktop and do it that way. I'm sure that Mac, like, IT admins know of way better tools to do this. I would love to hear about those because this is ridiculous. And I don't want to log into 48 Macs to do, like, OS updates down the road. So I would love to hear about those. But otherwise, just lots of learning about, like, how to run fleets of Macs. And Apple does not make that easy. They seem like they don't really spend a lot of time considering that. But it has been running just fine. It is working. One trick I learned, for a long time, there's been this in like what used to be called Mac OS Server and is now just built in. One of the things in the sharing panel is called content caching. And if you turn this on, I turned this on in my house a long time ago on the Mac Mini I keep in my house. Content caching, basically, like, Macs detect if there's a content caching server on the network. And if there's, like, a software update that comes through, the content cache Mac will download it. And then when every other Mac in your house does that software update, it'll just pull that copy over your local network. Instead of, you know, if you have five Macs, instead of each one downloading Mac OS, you know, 26.2.1 five times, you'll download it once to the content cache server, and then all of your other Macs will download it directly from that one. Well, that matters a lot when you have 48 Macs on a network. So, you know, I've designated a few of them to be content caches, and, you know, just little stuff like that. Like, it's been a really great overall experience. It's been a massive undertaking. Just, like, the amount of work this has been on so many levels, the signature algorithm, the transcript algorithm, like, building out the whole queue processing system for external servers that aren't in my main Linux server network, the health monitoring, the remote desktop, like, all, there's so much here. And, you know, then serving the transcripts, using them in the app, lining them up. Like, when you do get a different signature, like, how do you line up that signature with the one that the transcript has? There is so much work behind this. But where I've gotten is I got to learn a bunch of cool server stuff. I got to do some really tricky programming problems, which that's always fun for a programmer. if we're honest, we love tricky problems, even when they're frustrating and take months to figure out. But we do love when we finally figure them out. And now I have a very capable computational cluster that I can throw a bunch of work at, and it gets it done very cheaply. So this, I think, and I believe. I am the only podcast app to do private podcasts, at least server-side. I also believe I'm the only one where you can, like, do it on device if they don't have it. And I'm certainly the only one besides Apple that's going to do it for free. But that's – I think this was all worth it. I think the feature is great and will only get greater over time. Right now, it's very basic right now. It's, you know, you can view the transcript and you can tap, you know, it automatically scrolls with the audio. It highlights what's being said. You can tap anywhere in it. You can scroll around, tap anywhere in it to seek to that point. There's a lot of kind of obvious features that, like, well, once you have transcripts, you will obviously also want X. Things like transcript search. That's an obvious, like, number one. Like, yeah, you should be able to search transcripts. I'll get there. Things like, as I mentioned earlier, like chapterization, summaries of sections. Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of thing. Like, yeah, that I should do that. Clip sharing, where you can share a clip. Like, yeah, that should be transcript based, and the output should include the transcript. Yes, I agree. Like, there is so much that now follows from this, but this has taken me almost a year, and I wanted to get this. Like, I got to ship something. I got to get this out there. And even this, like, there were a couple of days last week where I broke the build on my own phone. I broke its ability to use transcripts. So for a couple of days, after I had been using them for a while, for a couple of days I couldn't use them, and I hated it. Like, I noticed immediately, because what I do is, like, I swipe over to the transcript view whenever I'm, like, listening to a big show that has stupid DAI ads. Like, I'll hear, great, another ad for the Apple Card. Awesome. Oh, another ad for Pure Leaf iced tea. Okay. And I can go over the transcript, and I can skim, and just tap right after, because it's very obvious where the ad ends. That's great. Like, features like that, you get used to that. Or even just, like, a what did they say kind of thing. Like, you can, like, you know, if you're listening to a podcast and a bus drives by and you miss a couple of words, you don't have to seek back and repeat the whole 20 or 30 seconds. You can just swipe and see, oh, that's what they said. Okay, easy. Like, stuff like that, it's really great for that kind of thing. It's also really great for, like, you know, if there's a podcast that, like, I know somewhere in here they mention something like this, you can quickly skim around and find it. Or if it's like, I got to listen to this episode before tonight, but I don't have that much time, but there's information in it that I would like to know generally what they talked about. That's all. You can skim the text of what they are talking about faster than you could hear it. So if they're talking about baseball, you can skip it, you know. So there's all sorts of little benefits like that. You know, much of the benefits of chapters in podcasts that do it, but just applied to all podcasts. It's a great experience, and it is very clear to me, having developed this and now using it, it is extremely clear to me that this feature is table stakes, that all podcast apps need transcripts, and once you are used to navigating a podcast with transcripts, using seek forward and seek back buttons feels like you're a dinosaur. So it is very obvious to me that podcast listening and podcast navigation require this. And this is where it is going. And so for any app that wants to be, like, a serious podcast experience, to be a good listening experience, you need robust transcript features now. And that will only get more so over time as we kind of evolve our UIs and our playback experiences to use them more and to offer more utility that's powered by transcripts. So I think this is, I don't always arrive to the party on time with this kind of thing, but I'm here now, and I'm very glad to be here. And it was a long road to get here. It was a ton of work and a ridiculous amount of unboxing Mac Minis, but I'm really glad that I'm finally here.
This does sound really incredible, and it sounds like it was an astonishing amount of work and expense to a not small degree. One of the things I keep wondering as you talk about this, to the degree you are willing and capable of sharing, how are you storing the transcripts? Because, you know,
that
the obvious
my first
answer
question
is,
as well.
Yeah,
Casey.
You know, the obvious answer is, oh, it's just a bunch of text. Well, no, it's not, because then you have timestamps, and
but I mean, where is he storing it?
Well, that
how.
Too, yeah.
The cloud, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but, like, where?
R2. Cloudflare R2.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what is the data type? I know some of this is special sauce, so you don't want to get too specific, but to the degree you're willing to share, like, what is being stored for each of these transcripts?
Well, you know me. Of course it's a custom format.
Of course.
I was going to say, it would normally be JSON, but knowing Marco, is not going to be JSON.
it's not JSON. I mean, there is JSON under there somewhere, but of course I'm like, well, if I customize it, I can compress it to be a lot smaller than that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's compression, there's shorthand, there's
the,
like, you know, delta encoding
for all the transcripts of all the podcasts in the world in text form gzipped can't possibly be that big.
No, well, I wasn't always storing them on R3. I started out storing them in a database, and like that was stupid.
R2, not R3.
But yes, sorry, R2. Yeah, but yeah. So it turns out databases were bad for this.
I think your problem is going to be that the minimum block size of R2 is probably bigger than all your transcript files. So it might actually behoove you to combine them into multiple files if you cared about storage, which you don't.
Well, but keep in mind also that like these transcripts. So right now in the UI in Overcast, it is displaying, you know, each kind of like line of text, so to speak. It's, you know, roughly like 1 to 2 sentences, maybe. It's, you know, it's displaying them like a series of short paragraphs. And when it is highlighting whatever is being spoken, it highlights the entire paragraph at once. But I actually have word level timing.
That was my next question.
Yeah, so the actual data I have is much more precise than what's showing. I have word level timing and word level confidence. So I'm actually storing a good amount of data for each transcript. Like I knew like if the API is going to give me this information, I'm going to store it. And you know, I might not necessarily use it for anything. At least maybe I won't use it now, but maybe down the road I will. Like for instance, if you're doing clip sharing, you know, if you look at what like there's other apps out there that will export videos that have like live captions of what's being said, and that tends to look a lot better if you highlight word by word. Or if you're doing something where it's exporting a video or a picture, and say like the current block of text is just too long to fit like in the frame, you'd want to be able to shorten it, and so you would need, you know, sub frame precision for that. So I'm like, if the API is giving me word level timing, I'm gonna store it. If it's giving me word level confidence, I'm gonna store that too. I don't store everything. Like there's some of it will give you like alternate transcription options. If it's like, if it's not too confident what was said, it'll say like, well, I think it's 60% sure it's this, but 40% sure it might be this. I did experiment with those at first, but I found that the alternatives that it was suggesting, they were such low confidence most of the time, it wasn't worth storing. So I mostly did not store those.
Yeah, on that front, by the way, that's another one of my questions. So you've got all these text transcripts now, and as you noted, you're using models optimized for the fact that they can run on the phone and they're inexpensive to run on the server and so on and so forth, and they're not going to be up to the standards of the gigantic models that, you know, that you could run in the cloud or whatever, right? But once you have the text, like as I was testing this feature earlier today, and I looked at the part of the previous episode where someone sang a line about someone walking the length of the city. and the transcription was, they say he walks the lake, L-A-K-E, of the city, because length and lake sound similar. But what I was wondering is, could you do a post-processing pass with some LLM thing where you feed it the text? Because I think any kind of good model would say the lake of the city doesn't make as much sense as walking the length of the city. Like it could figure out from context clues in the English language sentence structure that lake is the wrong word choice there. And especially if you have stored alternatives, it doesn't have to hear the audio. It's not correcting the transcription saying, oh, I'm going to use it more properly. Because obviously then you're just doing transcription twice. But I do wonder if doing like essentially text grammar correction or best guess correction with like a system prompt that says, you know, like if you had like a summary description of the podcast from the description in the feed, this is a technology podcast. I don't know if that would help with length of the city, but anyway, just a world knowledge model would pick out those lyrics and correct them and put in length. And I do wonder again, for maybe for the top 100 most popular podcasts in the most recent episodes, that doing a second pass and saying, this is my transcribed thing by my little models, and then chucking the text to another model and saying, fix this up and make it so it doesn't say lake of the city.
Yeah, so that is something I've thought about. And look, the accuracy of the on-device model is fine, but not amazing. And
you had to do the thing that everybody does, which is you put a big warning at the top and say, you know, this is auto-generated. There might be errors.
I said there are probably errors, because there are probably errors.
Yeah.
You know, because in my testing, it is good enough to know what's going on. It's good enough to have an idea of what's being said, to get most of it, and to figure out a lot of that stuff. It is not perfect enough to be like a document that you're going to show somebody, or
especially with like proper nouns and stuff like that, where it's going to struggle.
Right, exactly. Like it's the iPhone dictation model, I think, or roughly.
It's not like a world knowledge model that's going to be like, oh, I know the name of that because that's the name of a country and the capital of that country is. No, it's not doing that.
Right, like Whisper is better at that. Parakeet seems, in most people's testing, Parakeet seems like it is a little bit better at that. So that's why I'm going to look at that soon. But it's not like massively better, because that is mostly just down to like model size and complexity.
Yeah, are you resigned to redoing all of your transcripts on M7s with the more powerful model in a few years?
I can. So there is a versioning system in the transcript data. So.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, like, are you already setting up to say, like, I know I'm doing all this work, but at some point in the future, I'm going to have to redo it. All the whole back catalog again, because the models will have gotten that much better, and because the M7 will be that much more powerful.
I mean, yeah. So like, I expect over time this will get better. But like, so going back to like, if I like, using like a big model somewhere to clean up the transcripts, that is on my list to investigate. I think the costs would be prohibitive to do it for everything. But as you said, like if I just do it the same way, like have a popularity minimum. I wonder if
it's not transcribing audio, it's just text. I wonder if it would just be trivial for it, because like how much text is there, honestly? It's a tiny, it's like, forget about it. Like the text would fit in 1/1000th of the context window of these giant things these days. It's so much easier than transcribing audio,
Yeah. So like what I'm going to look at next, maybe not exactly next, but what I'm going to look at soon is, now that I have the transcripts, what smart things can I do with them? And that would be things like finding like topic changes and trying to make like a table of contents, make chapters that aren't that, if podcasters don't have them themselves, summarization of chapters maybe. So I could say, okay, at this part, they're talking about volleyball, like that's the kind of thing I want to be able to offer. And my plan in my mind, which I have not tested anything yet, but my plan has been to evaluate, like, that's when I go to the big API company or the big AI companies and use their APIs. So I would use the OpenAI or the Gemini or the Claude API to say, like, all right, here's this block of text. Find me where the topics are. Clean up any errors that you see that are probably unlikely to be what the person actually said. Stuff like that. That is the next big step in making transcripts better. I'm not ready to do that yet. Like, I had to get this part out first. But
can you use private cloud compute? Or is that only allowed to do like by users from shortcuts? Like, I'm wondering if you
so
could...
I could theoretically write a shortcut and shell it out to private cloud compute, but I think I would get throttled really quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there is a limit on that. Now, I mean, I'm thinking about like on device. Like, you mentioned obviously like transcript search, and full text search of transcripts, blah, blah, blah. You can do that all on device. Again, it's not that much text. You're searching through one podcast's worth of stuff, probably, even if you do all podcasts, whatever. But I also think there's a place for you to be able to do essentially LLM-powered search, where you just chuck the whole transcript into the context window and let the person ask a question, and it finds the part. You know what I mean?
So, like, for one episode, that's easy.
Yeah.
Doing it on device, doing that on the iPhone, the context window is only 4,000 tokens, so it's pretty tough.
Yeah.
But
all right. Well, that's what I was asking about private cloud compute. If you could just chuck the whole thing up to a cloud model, I feel like it would fit in the context window of a big cloud model.
Yeah, like it would absolutely fit. Like, if I wanted to offer that, like, with a big cloud model through an API, like, I could offer
bring
that
your own
way.
API key or whatever.
That's gross. I would find a way to do it cheaply. Like, I would see, like, what can I do for nothing or for near nothing? Because a lot of this. I mean, first of all, like API costs for high end models only going down over time, and that's only going to continue. And what I'm asking for is not that complex. Like, this wouldn't require like a really high end like thinking and logic reasoning model. Like, it wouldn't require that level.
Yeah, that you could run this on your Mac Minis with some like open weights like Llama model thing, because you're really just doing fuzzier full text search essentially. And I'm not saying you should do this first. You should just do plain full text search first, because no AI, no anything, just full text search. When people type in words and you match and blah blah blah. But because it is just text, any kind of remotely reasonable, small LLM-powered thing that you can fit the transcript into the context window and then just ask questions about it and get a timestamp out of it, that would be amazing. Because as someone who spends a surprising amount of time searching for transcripts, like when I tried to find the quote that I just read about the AirPods Pro Max thing, I foolishly didn't put that information in the reminder. So I'm like, oh, sometime in the past, we talked about AirPods
yeah, exactly.
Max. And Marco said something and I said something and I had to go find that. Just a little bit, just a little tiny bit of fuzziness helps. It goes a long way because, and especially for like, are the transcripts going to get AirPods Max? Is it going to get AirPods? So no, that's, I guess Air and Pods are two words and you have to think about sound alikes and stuff. And so I think any little bit you can do to help pass the sort of very simple full text, you know, non-AI full text search will really make this feature more powerful.
Yeah, and I think like that's something to look at, like, you know, in time, as all these things get cheap and I can run more of them locally. Like, you know, one limitation is that all these Mac Minis are just, again, they're the base model. They're the 16 gig of RAM, you know, base model. So there's only so much I can do on device when you start talking about bigger models. That being said, there's nothing stopping me from, say, adding a couple of high RAM Mac Studios to this, and then, you know, they would take on a certain type of job. Like, I could do
that.
What do you
think Apple's using for its transcripts? Are they using their M2 Ultra based servers?
Probably, yeah, because like, yeah, whatever Apple Podcasts is doing, yeah. Or they might have also done the same calculation and figured it's actually cheaper to just do a whole bunch of base Mac Minis, because it is. Like when you look at like number of, you know, transcription minutes per minute that you can get on the base model Mac Mini versus if you get like the highest end M4 Max, or I guess it's an M4 Pro in the Mac Mini. So the highest end M4 Pro, it's not twice. It's about twice as much at the most, but it's like four times the cost. So it's not worth it.
I have to imagine that they're using AWS servers to do their transcriptions, probably with Parakeet models, but I don't know.
Probably? Who knows?
Are you actually using Max to do podcast transcription, or is this all farmed out to AWS?
I mean, with Apple, it could go either way.
They have different deals than you would get with AWS in terms of pricing.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah, because again, like going through any, like doing all of this, like any answer that begins with, why don't you just... basically, like, why don't you just use AWS? Why don't you just use OpenAI, whatever it is?
Well,
like,
I just asked if you had priced it out. I think what
yeah,
you ended up
and
doing
yeah, the
would
answer
be
is
cheaper.
Thousands of dollars a day is what that costs.
Well, and you would also have to learn an entirely different set of things than you learn for this project.
True, yes. And one thing I also really like about the way I've built this is that I can run all the same code that I've already written. Like, so first of all, there's an advantage of, you know, Apple's APIs are really good for a lot of this stuff. So, for example, the music detection I'm doing, that's using Apple's built-in audio classifier. That is amazing. Like, it can do stuff like detect like when dogs are barking. Like, you know, I'm not using that part of it, but I could. And that's all just really easy. It's using platforms and languages and, you know, tools and all these things that I'm already familiar with, that I already am using, I'm already deploying, I'm already like in it. In this case, running these transcripts is using Overcast code. It's using Overcast, you know, it's the same code is running on the servers and in the app to generate transcripts. So I have the ability to do that in the app or the servers. I only write that code once. I'm able to use Swift instead of like PHP or whatever else I would use on the server. You know, there's all sorts of benefits to having this just be one code base. And like as I'm you know, getting older in my career, and as the world is getting more and more, like, you know, there's more and more in the tech business. No one can keep track of all of it. There's high value in specializing in an area. And so in my case, like, if I can write really good Swift code, or if I mean, to the extent that we're still writing code in a few years, who knows? But like, if I can write really good Swift code and I'm really familiar with Apple's platforms and Apple's APIs and Apple's like infrastructure and how to run all that stuff, it's easier for me to become an expert in that and to keep that up to date, rather than like I'm already falling way behind on my like Linux server side knowledge, just because I don't do that much of it anymore. I obviously still run a lot of servers for Overcast, but like, they're not changing that much. I'm not getting a bunch of new ones all the time. I'm not keeping up with like all the most modern like toolkits and things that everyone's using these days. Like, so specialization is, I think, high value to me. And so the fact that I can just run, like, I can do all this cool stuff using Apple's tools and using the languages I already know, and everything I run on the server can run on the phone. That's amazing. And then down the road, you know, if I'm still running Overcast in 10 more years, at that point, the phones will be so fast, I won't need these Mac Minis anymore. Like, my guess is I will probably never replace these, because by the time there would be like a major upgrade in performance that would be worth replacing M4s, I don't even know if I'll need these anymore, because the phones will be so fast, they might be able to do everything on device, and I might, like, there might be no reason to have all this work farmed out to these Mac Minis. But we'll see.
Then you'll need a coordinate server so that it knows, you know, this person A has already started transcribing the latest episode of the daily, so everybody else just hold off and wait for that. Don't bother burning your batteries.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe let two people do it just as a backup, or three.
Yeah, I mean, right now I already have that infrastructure in place. Like, right now the code is already there for the iPhone app to be a transcript worker. I'm just not activating that because there's not much that an iPhone can do in there's a type of background process. There's a type of background refresh task, not the one that was introduced in iOS 26 where you can like do the Final Cut export with live activity. Not that one. There's a previous one called a background processing task, and you can request the system wake up your app in the background and give you a block of like high CPU time when it is charging. So that way you can burn some battery power, and it's not like you're not like doing a disservice to the user because it's charging. So usually that'll run like when your phone is charging overnight, you know. And you can even say like, does it require power? Does it require networking? Whatever, and you can set those flags. And so I could use that time on like everyone's phones to do some work. I'm not, because that kind of feels a little wrong, because that kind of feels like I'm stealing resources from people. And the amount of work you can get done on an iPhone in that time slice, they give you like 3 minutes or something, it's not enough to even transcribe one episode of most things. So I'm doing all this work myself. But in 5 or 10 years, when the phones are a lot faster, some of that math changes. And maybe I can just do all of the work during people's overnight charging if I wake up everyone's phone for 1 minute and they can all do all the work. Like, maybe. I don't know. Maybe people can opt into it. I have no idea. But keeping all the code in Swift, in the iOS code base, or at least compatible with the iOS code base, even if I never do that scheme, that it still allows me to do things like you can, on demand, hit the transcribe button and transcribe a podcast I didn't get to yet or that I won't get to. So there's all sorts of benefits to doing it this way. So anyway, that's it.
I'm looking forward to you reinventing BitTorrent when you go the route of having all these phones do like a minute worth of transcription at a time. I can just see it now.
I wasn't thinking of using them as like a transcription farm, but rather instead like on demand, you know, because obviously the phone is already downloading an episode because you subscribe to a particular podcast, the RSS feed updates, the new episode downloads, you know, all that stuff happens on people's phones. And it's happening because they, you know, it's not like, oh, someone's using my phone to download podcasts. No, it's because you subscribe to it. Like, you control that. The user subscribes to a podcast and they want it to download the latest episode when it comes out, so that when they open Overcast and hit play, the episode is hopefully already there. That's already happening. I feel like part of that process could be, oh, and in addition to me downloading the episode, I'll also transcribe it for you. Or queue it up to transcribe that as soon as the Overcast is in the foreground or whatever. And I was saying, in that type of scenario, you don't want 70,000 people transcribing the new episode of the daily, right, when it comes out, because it's just a waste for all those phones to be doing the same work. But rather you just pick, well, these 10, everyone who wants to do it talks to a coordinate server and says, hey, I'm about to transcribe this episode. Are there any other phones out there already transcribing it? Because if there is, I'll just wait until they're done, because they'll transcribe, they'll upload the text, and I'll download the text, and, you know, that type of sort of energy saving type of thing. But yeah, that's definitely down the road when you have the computing power to do that. Basically, with the consent that it currently downloads. You know what I mean? Like, it's downloading because they subscribed. I think people will be fine saying, and also, when you download an episode from me, transcribe it too. And they don't care how it happens. They just don't want it to hurt their battery. They just want it to magically be there. And it's not really possible to do that now. But like you said, in a few years, I feel like if you did that, that would... people would accept that perfectly. They would accept it the same way they accept the fact that Overcast downloaded the episode for them.
Right, exactly. And like, there's already, like, right now I'm already doing what I can to share work where appropriate. So, like, for instance, the signature, the audio signature that, like, analyzes the audio and tries to line up with DAI, that is the same if the copy of the file you have is the same. So, and everyone has to compute the signature in order to line up the transcript from the server with their copy of the file. So you're computing the signature regardless. But it's a little bit heavy. It runs at like 600x or so real time. So, you know, it might take a couple of minutes, or it might take a minute for a podcast episode or something. And that does run on the phone. And it has to, because, like, the phone knows what it downloaded. I don't know what the phone downloaded.
Do you do a content hash before you even bother on the signature just to see if it's literally the same file, or do you not bother?
So first, I do, like, basically an MD5.
And, so you get, like, the deprecation warnings from the stupid MD5 library yelling at you that it's a broken algorithm and you don't care?
It isn't. I think it's one of the SHA families, but it's one of the fast SHA ones.
Okay. I'm still using MD5 and Xcode. Yeah, and I know there's a way to change it. You can use a different API to get it the same thing, but the different API is slightly slower. And I'm like, screw you. I'm just going to use this API forever. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, I first do, like, a file hash just to see. And then I go to the server and I say, do you have the signature for this file hash? So... Yeah. Everyone who downloads ATP, since we don't use dynamic ad insertion, only one person is ever going to generate that signature, and it's probably going to be the transcript servers that do it, because they're also embedding the signature that they get in the transcripts. So for podcasts that don't use DAI, the phones don't have to do this work at all. Because
you need to add a button to the ATP CMS that I can click that forces immediate transcription of the latest ATP episode.
We don't need to. It's a popular podcast on Overcast, so it'll be prioritized.
I know you have the ping feeds API that people use. I'm just asking for the equivalent of that for transcription.
Yeah. Well, no. That's not going to happen. But anyway.
Not a public one, just for us.
No, I don't need to.
All right, we'll see.
Yeah. Or you can download the episode onto your phone and transcribe it for everybody. But yeah, so the signature thing, yeah, it's like it checks, it hashes the file first in the fast way, asks the server, hey, do we know what the signature of this hash is yet? And for most podcasts, most of the time, they'll have that. The only reason you would have to transcribe, you would have to use the signature yourself or generate yourself, is if the version of the file that you got has different ads than anybody else has gotten, then your phone will generate the signature for that hash and submit it to the servers. So I am doing work sharing as much as possible there. So, like, the work for the signatures isn't being duplicated. The work for the transcripts isn't being duplicated. But, you know, it's still... It has to happen sometime, but yeah, usually you're not facing that on your phone.
So if I get a copy of 99PI that's got local Richmond ads and nobody else has seen these ads yet, how are you making the transcript from that? Like, are you uploading my MP3 to your server to churn on it?
Oh God, no, no. I mean, that would be impossible. So in that context, what would happen is your phone would download the transcript that Overcast already has for that episode. The transcript would be, as you mentioned, for like a different set of ads that was injected in the in the copy that my servers got. And your phone would generate its signature for the file it has. And then it would look at its signature and the transcript signature, and it would, like, find the common ranges between them. Like, where, so basically, like, whatever is not different between the two copies, it finds those, aligns the server-side transcript to those on your local copy. And then any ranges in your local copy that were not on the server copy, it just doesn't transcribe those. So you'll see gaps in the transcript with, like, an ellipsis there, which I believe is the same thing that Apple Podcasts does on their transcript. So your phone is never doing its own transcription if you don't want it to, primarily because they're just too slow to do it right now, you know, unless it's in one of those special tasks. Anyway, so your phone is doing the bare minimum work it needs to do to figure out what audio was it served. And then how does it line up the transcript to that audio?
Gotcha.
You could do a local transcription of just the ads.
I could. I mean, why?
Yeah.
We're sponsored by True Leaf iced tea, or whatever it is. The Verge cat.
I'm just so glad I don't
say that over and over again.
Because it's just, I hear everyone talking about it, and it's, I mean, I guess I've heard a few of them, and it's not great, but yeah.
Yeah, I signed up for the Verge's paid thing, which has ad-free podcasts finally, thank God. But they
still have the ad bumper, so it's weird.
A lot of my shows that
I mean, I know we have
that,
the ad bumpers too, but I feel like it's incorporated in a way that you wouldn't know. It just sounds like a segment break, but their thing totally sounds like places where ads should go.
I have the paid search engine podcast one, and their ad bumper is like 45 seconds long. It's huge musical science. I have to like skip forward past it every time. Even though I have the Verge membership, I've been still keeping the Verge cast public feed so I could test how my transcripts handled DAI. Mm-hmm. And I've heard the same ads so many times between that. And like Trevor Noah is probably the biggest, like the most popular podcast I've probably listened to, I think. And that, of course, is full of DAI. Like all the big shows are full of DAI. And I'm kind of looking forward to having this finally be out there and having the signature stuff be, I think, done. So I can stop listening to all these ads and just go back to the membership versions.
One final quick feature request for the olds in the audience. You need to make that text bigger, or at least an option to make the text bigger on the transcripts, and also make the margins fatter.
It is following the body text size that you set. So it should, it scales up with dynamic text.
There needs to be a separate setting for that. I mean, I'm thinking of like the lyrics in Apple Music, how huge they are. I'd be happy if they were that big, but I understand music lyrics tend to be shorter than podcasts, so maybe there's some limits there. But my old eyes say, why is this text so small? And also maybe do bold for the current section instead of regular for the current section and faded gray for the other ones. Anyway, those are my two quick feature requests.
Yeah, UI for it is very much like a 1.0 version of this UI.
And bold the current word since you have that info. You know, the whole deal.
The reason I didn't do bold is that bold causes the text to change width and therefore reflow.
There's no San Francisco variant that doesn't do that?
Actually, I don't know.
Obviously there's monospace numerals, but I wonder if there's a variant that does not change metrics when you bold it. But anyway,
I don't think that, well, then but I will check.
Then just change the color of the current word, because you got the info. That'll really help, like the read along type thing of seeing the word, like the little blue word or whatever color you make up. That'll be great.
Yeah. Well, and what Apple does with their transcripts is they like the whole thing. It's almost like the genie effect, or the what's the zoom effect on the dock when you hover over things?
Scale.
Yeah.
Those genie.
Genie is when the minimize window comes out and
sorry. Yes.
Yeah, it's like the effect of like when
magnification is what you're thinking of on the dock when the icons get bigger.
When you scroll your cursor over the dock icons and the one you're on grows up in size and the other ones shrink around it. Yeah, they do that with their transcript text. So the current line of the transcript is bigger and bolder, and the rest kind of like fade into smallness and into the sides.
Yeah, that's not great.
It does solve some problems. I think it creates others, but. Yeah. You know, so I will play with the UI. There's a lot of iteration to be had here, but got to start somewhere.
Oh, this looks incredible. You should be very proud. I know this was a lot of work.
I can't believe you're announcing it when it's beta, though, because now everyone's like, when is this going to be released?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, the good thing is, honestly, it's a big enough deal. I considered skipping the beta and just going directly to the public.
Good idea.
I realized that was not wise.
I know you're anxious to get it out. The beta.
But I don't expect this to be in beta for very long. Because my goal here is not to revamp the whole feature with beta feedback. My goal here is make sure it works to the level, like to the 1.0 level, and then get it to everybody. So we will see.
All right. You said it would be half an hour. It was 82 minutes.
That's it.
Pretty accurate if you add the Marco multiplication factor.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I thought I was going to have this done by the fall, so you know.
Fair. All right, titles.
Wait, we got to do everything.
Oh, Jesus Christ, we didn't even do the post show, did we?
No, I first have to end the main show.
Oh my God, all right.
We were sponsored this episode by 1Password, Zapier, and Lisa, and also supporter, jeez, hold on. I messed this whole thing up.
Rewind.
All right.
Redo.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, 1Password, Zapier, and Lisa. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about goals and features and the future of liquid glass in Apple's 27 series OSs coming out this summer and fall. That'll be fun. I'm looking forward to that. There have been a couple of rumors recently on that, so we will talk about that in Overtime. atp.fm/join to join us to hear that. Thank you so much, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, so there is some new news that broke. It was spoiled, I think, yesterday as we record, and is officially news, I believe, today. The BMW i3 reveal has happened. This is not the little car.
Yeah, not Tiff's car.
Is that the sound it makes?
Yep, that's it. That's right.
Well, no, actually, the old BMW i3 was before EVs were required to make all those noises, so it actually makes no noise.
In any case, the i3 has been announced. So this is the Neue Klasse or something like that. I'm sorry, Germans. That is basically, let's make an EV from the ground up rather than taking the petrol cars, the gasoline cars, and retrofitting an EV into them. Even though, I mean, again, I'm an apologist for the i4 because I thought it was incredible. But this is from the ground up, let's make an EV. And so reading from a couple of sites, starting with The Verge, Sebastian Kroes, BMW's head of interior design for the Neue Klasse cars, told me that the iX3 was designed with an emphasis on verticality to make it look taller. The i3, on the other hand, has an emphasis on horizontality. I don't think I'm pronouncing either of those words right. I don't think they're words either, but I'm doing the best I can.
If you're a German designer, it is.
Yeah, I'm doing the best I can here.
This is designees.
Yeah. Most directly seen in the series of lights that span virtually the sedan's entire nose. The company hasn't quoted a formal capacity for the i3, but I'd expect it to fall somewhere around the 109 kilowatt hour usable battery capacity of the iX3 SUV, enough for what BMW says is 440 miles on a charge. And 400 kilowatt charging should mean that adding over 200 miles of range happens in about 10 minutes. Neither of the two motors in this car uses permanent magnets, which has a few advantages. First, you'll find no rare earths here. Secondly, the i3 can disable its motors and coast without needing a disconnect system, unlike the Mercedes, which apparently does. From Ars Technica, weight distribution is close to 50-50 with a low center of gravity thanks to the battery pack, and torque delivery is rear-biased out of corners, and under regenerative braking, the rear axle regens more than the front at first to stabilize the car. So, technology-wise, this looks really, really good. Like, this looks incredibly impressive. Visually, I'm not as convinced. So, to my eyes, the profile is excellent. The front is a vast improvement from the pig nose of the i4. You know, when I told you I loved the i4, I said that while just ignoring the fact that the kidneys took up the entire front of the car. This is better. It's a little weird, but it's better. I don't think I like the back at all. And the interior, I am not here for the vertical braces on the steering wheel. You're just going to have to see to understand. And I'm not here for the trapezoidal center screen thing. However, on the whole, this looks really good.
You mentioned this being spoiled yesterday or whatever. Well, the way BMW has rolled this out has been, I mean, you know, obviously, they had the original like concept cars, the Neue Klasse, whatever, however many years ago those came out. And then obviously the iX3 is out and you can buy and is the first car on this platform, although it's not a sedan, obviously. But this car, this exact car, the i3, they've been doing the thing for, I think, maybe a year, at least 6 months or so, where they've been allowing journalists to see and show the car, quote-unquote, disguised. And if you're in the car world, you know the normal way you disguise cars is you put a bunch of things on the car that use, like, black and white, like, dazzle camouflage with just all sorts of weird, swirly black and white patterns to make it so you can't get a read for what shape the car really is. Often there'll be kind of like a bra over the front and rear so you can't see what the front grille looks like, and sometimes they put other panels on it of, like, cardboard or wood or whatever to just hide the shape of the car. But this car, the i3, has been shown to journalists with essentially a wrap on it, meaning, like, if you put a red wrap on your car, people think your car is painted red. Just a wrap. But instead of the wrap being red, the wrap is dazzle camo. So it's like, how much of this car are you hiding when you just essentially put a wrap on it, where you can see the whole car, and yeah, it's maybe a little bit harder to see what shape it is, but there's the car. There's nothing disguising it except for an ugly paint job, essentially. But still, I was holding out hope that when I saw the finished version of it, it would not be as homely as the camouflaged cars they've been showing to the press. I mean, they would let them drive them in the snow and do all this stuff, but that's the car. And anyway, there's not much that can be done to save this. I was hoping that they could de-emphasize those giant headlights on the front with styling that was not apparent with the wrap on it, but nope, they're there, they're big, I don't like them. And also, in general, even though they said this car emphasized horizontality or whatever, it looks tall, especially compared to the existing i4. I think the existing i4, like, did they make a coupe of this? Whatever i4 I've seen on the road, I've taken pictures of it before. The current i4 body shape and back looks so good and so
pretty
and athletic and nice. And then you get to the front and it's got big beaver teeth. I understand that. I'm not a fan of the front. But if you never see the front and you just see it from the side and the back, it looks amazing. This car looks tall and squat from the side. This car has ugly taillights and an ugly rear. And this car's front, I think, is not actually an improvement over the buck teeth. It's just ugly in a different way.
You are so wrong, sir.
As for Casey's steering wheel that he doesn't like, I think I posted this on our little Slack channel. I think if you get the M Sport steering wheel, those spokes are hard. I put a picture of it into our Slack. Those spokes are horizontal, not vertical, which helps it a little bit. But I am also dubious about the comfort of the steering wheel because of the way that it's not like a tube around it. They've really done these big cutouts and like these strange sort of, you have to look to see it. It's a strange steering wheel. I'll give them credit for making the squircle a little bit more Urkel-y than squirr. I mean, it's not a circle because you can't put circles on car wheels anymore because it's against the law, but it's not as bad as like, say, the Corvette wheel, which is just really weird hexagon thing. I do like that they've updated their architecture. This is basically the same same architecture as the iX3, so it's good. I think they went to 800 volt with this, so I'm sure it'll be a great car, but just the styling problems happening over there in Germany continue to be dire. I mean, not all in Germany, because I feel like Porsche styling has still been pretty good, and I'm mostly on board with it, and Mercedes styling, but BMW styling, they've been in a rut for, what, 2 or 3 decades now?
I don't think it's near as bad. Certainly this doesn't look near as bad to me as it does to you. And I don't think it's been 2 decades. It's probably been 1-ish. But
no, you start with the bangle butt. That's the 90s, right? Or is that 2000?
No, that was early to mid-2000s, I believe. And even, I don't know. And it wasn't all of the cars. It was some of the cars. I don't know. Like, the 3 Series has mostly been good with, like, the E90 that I had was good. The F10 was most, or no, that's the 5 Series. And F30 is what I'm thinking of. Mm-hmm. F30 was all right. And then it got ugly after that.
Yeah, we just didn't know what was going to happen. So you look back in the F30 and you're like, wow, that was nice.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah, by comparison. Yeah.
And it's got dumpster handles. It's got basically Tesla door handles in 2026, 2027 model year. You're going to do Tesla door. They're not exactly the same because there is a mechanical pull on them, I believe. But I think they might still have to redo them for China. You know, we did that story about China banning electronic door handles. I think they might still have to redo them for China just because the electronic mechanism makes it come out like the Model S handles. So it doesn't matter that there's a mechanical pull if you can't actually get your fingers behind the thing because they made it like, why? Why? As you noted, Casey, the i4 has flush door handles that you just put your fingers under and pull. And I don't even know if those are mechanical. Those might be electronic switches. But the point is they could be mechanical because you don't need anything to happen. You just walk up to the car, stick your fingers underneath the handle and pull like it's, I sent you that video of like the Honda Prelude thing, whatever that was, like 1995 Honda Prelude. Flush door handles, 100% mechanical. You just put your fingers underneath it and you pull and the door opens. But no, not on the BMW i3. They have to electronically come out like it's 2012 and you're a Model S. So dumb.
With the exception of the door handles, I think both the iX3 and the new i3 look probably like incredible cars. Like,
yeah, I agree. I think these are going to be
good cars. I just don't like the styling, and I don't like the shape of the steering wheel. I also don't like the trapezoid screen, but I do like the like distant dashboard, that stripes thing. I think that's actually a good idea. Lots of other cars have done that. I mean, Toyota Prius famously started this trend, I think, of like putting things farther away than you think they would be, and I think it does work. Yeah, and it might be a little tight in the backseat. I'll have to wait till I see some of tall YouTubers get into this thing. But it's nice that they updated their platform. I think they have a bright future because they're as you've noted with the i4, their previous platform, which was hacked into their gas car platform, was already pretty good. And presumably they've learned things since then. So I think this car will be a great car as long as you can, you know, stay inside it so you don't have to see the outside.
Honestly, the i3 looks incredible to me overall. Like, I don't share how much you hate it. I think it looks great. And you know, is every single detail of it perfect? No, but overall, I think it looks great, and I would be very happy to drive that car around. I think as I think of, like, you know, what will my next car be? Like, my current lease is, you know, it has about a year and a half on it. I think I'm going to look very hard at the i3 and the iX3. I wish the i3, it still doesn't have a hatchback, right? Isn't it? It's still like a regular trunk.
Yeah. Although they apparently showed a touring version, which to us is a wagon.
Well, probably not going to be in this country.
Yeah,
probably
not
here, but it will exist somewhere, allegedly.
Yeah, they always get better models in Europe. But yeah, like the iX3 looks just smaller and sleeker enough compared to my iX that it might be nice. But it still has like the utility of the big liftback trunk, which I do like and use all the time. I think even though I would love to have like one of these regular sedan i3s to drive around most of the time, I think I would really hate not having a liftback trunk now, because I got so, like, ever since the Model S, like, I'm so spoiled by having a big trunk opening. It's so useful. It's so good. I don't think I can really have a car without it anymore. So I would love to have this car at some point, but I don't think I would be happy with it. And I'm hoping that, like, whatever the next gen of the i4, maybe we start to see what that starts to look like, because that could be a good future car for me as well. But
yeah, I don't know why more people don't copy what Tesla did with the S. Just the lift back on a sedan is such a good idea. Everyone should be doing it. I think who does it?
Audi does it.
Audi does it. Porsche has, well, they have the weird, the ugly Taycan with the...
Yeah,
wagon.
Yeah. One Taycan
was
it. Yeah, the i4.
The i4 was a liftback, you know, because it's an i4 Grand Coupe.
I think they mostly do it because of NVH. Like, it's harder to, like, isolate the cabin, and people want a luxury car and yada yada. But it can be done. I just think more people should copy it.
Yeah, it's a
don't
massive
copy the door handles. Copy the liftback.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All right, titles.
Let's see.
You could replace Tiff's i3 with a new i3.
She would hate that. Oh, she would notice. She would hate it. Let's see.
I mean, I do love fondling the edges. Let's see. The feet are rounded and friendly is pretty good.
Just rounded and friendly maybe is a better title.
Yeah, I like that.
I didn't want to melt my rug actually is very good as both a what the hell are they talking about and also...
that's a blasphemy. No Mac Mini is getting hot enough to melt anything. Come on.
But when you put six of them on an iPad, they generate a decent amount of heat.
I don't know. I think those are my favorites.
I like rounded and friendly and melt my rug. Let me see what else is in here.
I like the rug better than the rounded and friendly a little bit.
So do I.
All right. Go with rug.
Cool. That was easy.
Okay. I didn't want to melt my rug. All right, just give me a second to put it in the robot. Oh, actually, shoot, I'm missing a couple URLs. So goof off for a second.
Option, shift, a left square bracket, Casey, please.
Oh, is it the smart quote on the don't or the didn't?
Yep.
Oh,
I'm telling him the keys to stroke to hit in case he doesn't know.
I don't. That doesn't bother
option,
me.
Option, shift, left square bracket.
Nope. Nope, that's not it.
It's not it? It's got to be it. Let me see.
I still search Google for RSQuo, and then I like find what used to be RSQuo.net.
Oh, it's right bracket. Did you say right bracket?
Yeah, no. They did it, as discussed many times. What they should have done is opening his left bracket, closing his right bracket, but that is not what they did, and it's been driving me insane. I always just try both of them, but now you have to go through the same thing. Just try both brackets. One of them is the right
one. I got there. All right, give me one more second. And then...
Like, it's right there. They're opening and closing brackets. It should be the opening, but no.
Yeah, I don't know what they were thinking. All right, let me grab all this copy and paste, and we are good to go. 2 more seconds. All right, let's see if John's stuff lets me save it. Does. Okay. Goodbye, live people. We are on time next week, as far as I know. But I got to talk to the boys. Maybe not the next week. After that, the week of the first, we might move it. So we'll see.
Cool. Bye, live people.
All right. Bye, live people.